Chicago band Twin Peaks, the Paramount Theater's Tim Rader, and another installment of Touché with Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling. And now, here's your host, a man who took the weekend to binge watch all of season 12 of Keeping Up with the Kardashians, Justin Kaufman.
I'm not afraid to say it. Best show on TV. Suspense, drama, clothes. That's all I could come up with. Suspense, drama. It should be fake suspense, fake drama, and clothes. I gotta say, I know it's very unpopular, and I know the mainstream will quickly denounce everything that has to do with the Kardashians, but I am telling you, it is addictive television. I want to know what's up with Kim and Kanye. I want to know what's up with Khloe and Lamar, Courtney and Scott, Chris and her 32-year-old boyfriend.
Why?
Because they've done a good job of they've developed these characters, and for whatever reason, because it feels like it's reality, I'm hooked. I'm getting back in with Rob and Black China too. I don't know what it is, man. I know. The text's already lighting up. Like, are you crazy? And I'm like, no, I'm not. I know. If you're going to pick by decade, I'd say like the 2010s best show, Kardashians. If this were the 90s, it'd be Reba. I get it. Speaking of, I watched a little Reba today. I realized that Freeform, the old ABC Family channel, runs Reba. I don't know if it's just Mondays. I rarely watch TV during the day.
Mm-hmm.
But they run a marathon of Rebas back to back. And so not only did I get the best thing in the world, which was the Reba theme song, still by far the best theme song in television history, but I got, at the end of one of the episodes, they must have been short, so they did a blooper reel.
Ah, I always like the show. Blooper reels.
A lot of like, zoing, like she screws up a line and then gives a funny face to the camera. A lot of that. But it was very 90s. Imagine that in the 90s. So, or early 2000s, I guess, would be Reba. But the Kardashians, good stuff. I recommend season 12.
I can't believe they're on season 12 of that show.
Season 12. And I got to say, I know, like I said, texts are coming in, but I think Kim is a star. I think Khloe is a star. I think Kris Jenner is a star. I think they've deep-sixed Caitlyn Jenner. She's not on
Gone.
That show. She's got her own show. They're like, you're not a part of this clan. Kanye, it's fun to watch Kanye sort of be told by a director where to stand and then stand there and pout.
Is he on there quite a bit?
He's on there enough. I think the episode that was just on was, it might have been the new one, or I can't remember because I binge watched him, but there was one where they're in Iceland, which is like where everyone goes now because Iceland must be given like a ton of freebies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, come shoot your video here. Shoot your movie here. Like, everybody, Iceland just makes its way into every plot line and every television and movie right now. And it's no different for the Kardashians. It's like, well, we went to Iceland, you know, because we do for business. No, you didn't, because they paid for you to go to all the tourist spots.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing that annoys me. You've already hooked us. We're buying everything that's on the show. You don't have to be so blatant in your cross promotion. I digress. Still a good show. But he was shooting the video for Highlights, which is off of Life of Pablo, mm-hmm. which is a great song. But so she was there for that. And I don't know, man. Scott Dickers, Tyga, Kylie, Kendall.
I understand the half of those words.
Black China. There's a lot of feuds going on. It took me a while to catch up. A lot of Googling. But I got to say, Pete, I'm amazed. I know that automatically people are like, no, 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 no on the Kardashians. But they are so savvy when it comes to their
brand, yeah,
and their brand. I mean, they're putting articles out today. There's a bunch of news out based off of yesterday's article or yesterday's show, which was just regurge from 6 months ago when the actual news came out. So they're able to. Everyone always says, "Go to our website." You know, mm-hmm. they say the download. Go to WGNRadio.com for more. And then you get there, and you're like, there's not much more. The Kardashians have figured out a way to use entertainment news, especially E, to essentially continue their storylines. It's brilliant. It's stupid. like David St. Hubbins says in the beautiful movie Spinal Tap, it's a fine line between stupid and clever. And that's where the Kardashians lie. And I have to say, I love it. They hooked me. And I feel to be somewhat of a savvy, you know this about me, I'm somewhat of a savvy consumer of all things entertainment.
Have you not watched any of them before?
I've watched them begrudgingly. And I've always watched them, and they're in the background. And a lot of it is to hate watch it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's still part of it. You laugh at some of the stupid things when they're like, this shampoo is great. Oh, it's my new shampoo, Ma. It's Courtney shampoo. And you're like, all right, stop. Stop. But I have to say, like, I'm really into it. I really like the show. I like the characters. They're likable characters. I understand the blowback. And Jezebel does a great job on Mondays. And we should get the people from Jezebel on. You know, we know Kate Dries over there, who's the managing editor. We should make a deal for on Mondays.
A recap everything?
We should do a recap. Because what they do at Jezebel is brilliant. What they do is they break down when they shot the fake stuff. So they'll find out, like, big news was that Rob Kardashian and Blac Chyna, they are now engaged. Mm-hmm. They're going to have a baby. Okay, spoiler alert. Which was out 6 months ago, so now it's on the TV show. It's 4 months, 2 months, 6 months, all over the place. But my point being that, you know, they go through on Jezebel, and they point out what scenes were taped after the fact. So a lot of what happens on the reality show Keeping Up with the Kardashians, they fake the reaction shots. I mean, they already know that he's getting married.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go, okay, now let's shoot. Now let's shoot where you find out. Like, fake that. That's when everyone says it's fake. Everything on it is fake. But it's like,
yeah.
But once you recognize that, who cares?
I mean, it's just entertainment.
It's entertainment. I'm not buying any of their stuff. They don't got me that. They don't have hooks that far into me.
Yet.
There is some good looking lipstick. I'm not going to lie. Welcome to the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Got a great show lined up for you tonight. It is Pitchfork Festival Week here in Chicago. It's this weekend. That means that some of the best and brightest bands and musicians from all over the world are going to be in Chicago this week. It's sort of like a perfect time for independent music here in town. And a lot of those acts coming on the download this week, including Digable Planets, which will be on the show a little bit later. Great act, Shamir. Also, we'll be talking to so many more, including tonight, two local bands that are on the lineup who are just turning heads everywhere they go. The rock band Twin Peaks, which is a great Chicago band that just played Conan last week or the week before. And also the band Whitney. Band Whitney's going to perform in Studio 435 tonight. It's a real treat to have both of these bands. I mean, these are kids that are doing something. I mean, to see the followings and where they play and the big festivals. I mean, this is an amazing, amazing time for music in Chicago. And it mostly centers around the hip hop community. But in this case, these are two rock bands that are turning heads in L.A., in New York, and all around the world. Well, right? Don't you think?
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing, too, just trying to coordinate them to come on the show. They're always gone. They're always on the road. Like,
I think Iceland.
They go to Iceland. They're here for just this week, and then come after Pitchfork, they're off to Europe again, and they're off doing another tour. They're like never. They're just on the road all the time, playing shows all across the country and the world. Amazing.
Mm. Yeah, they're great. It's amazing to have them here. I mean, it's how many times you can get these bands in studio and all together to come in and talk about what they do and play music. It's awesome. Also tonight on the show, Touche coming up a little bit after the 7:30. We got a lot to talk about in the political world. The Republican National Convention begins next week. Wow, what timing. Cleveland is going to be a show. We'll just put it that way. Philadelphia the week after as well. We'll have Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling in studio with us tonight. That's coming up a little bit later in the hour. And also Tim Rader's going to be here. He's the president and CEO of Paramount Theater in Aurora. This is interesting. Tim's an old friend of mine, and he also he's been given the key to the city, and he also is he was the grand marshal at the parade, the July 4th parade for the city of Aurora. The city of Aurora essentially started this concept, the Paramount Theater, and Tim took it over, and he brought Broadway theater and a lot of great shows to Aurora, to the western suburbs, really as a way to keep people in the western suburbs, to keep them in Aurora, not go to neighboring Naperville or maybe to downtown Chicago, and it's worked. People are coming out in droves to go to the Paramount Theater to see some of their shows that they put up, original shows, also Broadway shows, And Tim Rader, who has a history in doing those kind of shows, is going to be with me tonight at the big table to talk about being a part of the redevelopment of Downtown Aurora at the Paramount Theater. So that's coming up at the big table, 8 o'clock. So lots to do tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll hit the carry out right after the break. Stay with us. Let's go to the text. 815. Kardashians, good night, pal. Switching off. There's also 630, you're scaring me. 219. Kardashians, that's because you, sir, are an idiot. It's okay to have a guilty pleasure, right? That's what I wrote back to the texters. I'm like, well, I don't want to know what you're... I mean, I'm sure there's some things that you're like... Because someone says, I never watched a minute and I'm proud of it. Well, there's probably some things you're not proud of. You're like, well, maybe I will watch this lady golf.
How can you criticize something that you've never seen before?
Well, you watch it and you'll then be able to say, oh my God, I criticize this. This is terrible.
And I think it's okay to not even... Just be... It's a pleasure for you. Why do you have to feel guilty about something?
I agree. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'll take that. Yeah. Take that.
I mean, I think you're a dummy for liking it, but I feel proud of it.
You're proud of it. I mean, it's everyone's got a guilty pleasure. Maybe it could be another segment for us to talk about, but mine would definitely be the Kardashians. And I, to be honest, it's a new one because I don't know if it was just watching it. It was after dinner, so it's a little full, maybe a glass of wine. I was just like, you know what? I feel bad for Chloe when she's going through. Is Courtney and Scott, they're going to get back together? Like, I was like, another one. I seriously watched like four last night. And they were out of order, too, so I had no idea what was happening. But I just kept going, why do they keep, oh, jeez. So there is, like I said, there is a little bit of hate watch in there. But go Kardashians. I'm with it. We should get the Kardashians. We should start becoming the voice of the Kardashians here in Chicago. So when they come through, they'll be on the show. Instead of like going to B96 or something.
Yeah.
Where they just go, hey, I got some new perfume. Yeah, what's up? You're hilarious, DJ D.
Yeah, let's get the AM crowd. They already have the FM crowd. Yeah.
Come on over to the AM crowd. Let's do a big table with Kris Jenner. Right? Now we're talking. I guess I don't know if we are talking. All right, let's get the carry out. This is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Big protest this weekend in Chicago, disrupting the taste. Good. I hate $9 beers, too. One of the Black Lives Matters organizers, Jamal Green, was arrested for attempting to disarm an officer and other felony assault charges. Protesters want him released. He was arraigned today, and the judge did not throw it out. Instead, set bail at $350,000. Protesters chanted, Black Lives Don't Matter, in the courtroom. Clever. Green was one of the 19 people arrested over the weekend for protesting. Today, youth activists protested police brutality by sitting in at Millennium Park. Hey. There were one bottle of rosé and some fancy crackers away from being at a Bodine's concert. So there you go, kids. In other news, a federal judge ruled on a case that would have some ramifications for, well, everybody. Essentially, it's now a federal crime to share your Netflix password. This ruling, if enforced, would end Netflix as we know it because, let's face it, nobody actually pays for it. I don't pay for it. And to my college roommate, Tony, why do you keep watching RuPaul Drag Race? Just keeps showing up. We're a week away from the RNC in Cleveland. Delegates started working on issues, and, well, they have stood firm on an anti-LGBT platform. No abortions, no same-sex marriage, no gay adoptions, no gender bathroom mumbo-jumbo. This will all be up to vote next week at the convention. Some critics say it will alienate the possible GOP gay voter. But then again, Trump. Oh. Can't really alienate anymore. Stocks open today on a high note, setting records, breaking the record from last year. So that end-of-the-world Brexit stuff, was that just a dream? A really cute English dream? Forget Cameron and Brexit for a second. German officials released a report today saying that over 1,200 women were reportedly sexually assaulted on New Year's Eve. What? From what I could gather, it was roving mobs of 30 to 40 men at a time. They were the perps, just going up to women and assaulting them in cities of Hamburg and Cologne. Jesus, that's like lawlessness. Critics say that the men were Syrian refugees.
Sorry. Punishment should be that the offenders go right back to Syria. You grope, you get thrown out of an airplane on the wrong side. That's Kaufman justice. You're gone. I said good day. So I'm just getting ready for a new cable show I'm pitching. Kaufman justice, where I wear a cowboy hat. Metra has launched a new campaign targeting nasty riders called Ride Nice. This is a campaign to get rid of little things like putting your bags on open seats or manspreading or talking on your cell phone. Wait, is it Ride Nice or is it See Something, Say Something? You're confusing me here, Metra. A new study out says that Chicago is third when it comes to our tolerance of public displays of affection, i.e. kissing in public. We were beat by Dallas and San Diego. Listen, I know we're a tolerant city, but they didn't poll me. I'm not a big fan of the sidewalk tongue kiss. Keep it in your mouth. Wait, that should be the new Metro slogan. Keep it in your mouth. Not see something, say something. Keep it in your mouth. I see it. Pokemon Go's all the rage. An app that uses GPS to lead users to locations where they can unlock characters is so popular that the anti-Pokemon Go stories have emerged. Criminals have used it to rob users, and the app tracks your data, your private data. But no matter if you have my private information or that criminals are stalking me, I might get to unlock Pikachu. That's all that matters. Pokemon Go is a great name, but I prefer the app's working title. I don't want to be an adult anymore. In weather, it's hot. So hot. In sports, it's officially the All-Star break. The Cubs and Sox get a few days off from the grind of playing a kid's game for a living. Chris Sale will start the All-Star game for the AL and Johnny Cueto for the NL. Johnny Cueto, the rent-a-player who's been with four teams over the past 3 years, who once tried to spike a player with his shoe in the neck. Remember that? He was on the Reds? Who made this decision to have Johnny Cueto start the NL All-Star game over reigning Cy Young winner Jake Arrieta? Who could it be? Right, the old guy who coaches the Mets. Am I the only one that calls bullcrap on this one? Just another New Yorker disrespecting Chicago. There's been no pitcher who's been as downright dominant from All-Star game to All-Star game in baseball history. Arrieta is naked in a magazine. I'm not a homer Cub fan here, and I know that Arrieta's had a couple shaky starts, but didn't Cueto pitch for the AL last year in the World Series? It's annoying. Mets. If I were Coach Madden, I'd make this bulletin board material, or at least let the players know about your feelings during the next pajama karaoke spaghetti day. Is Madden coaching the Cubs, or is he the coach of the Park District camp? Can't tell. The NBA Summer League has begun, or as I like to call it, graduate school basketball. Not quite college, not quite NBA, not quite entertaining. The Bulls are playing. That's all I got. Tim Duncan retired from the Spurs. What a great career. He played in one city his entire career. Wow, is there a modern Bulls star that's done that? Jordan? No. Pippen? No. Rodman? No. Kukoc? Heinrich? Gordon? Kerr? Rose? Noah? Eee, what does that say? A lot of pressure, Bobby Portis. A lot of pressure. A big recruit chose Illini basketball today. The beginning of something interesting or a two-year transfer to Kentucky? We'll see. We shall see. And finally tonight, a naked man stole a truck downtown and then he flipped it over on Lakeshore Drive and then he jumped into the lake to escape, only to be caught. Now imagine if this guy got on the Metra. Yes, I see something. This time, I see something. That's the carryout for July 11, 2016. Hey, do you want a receipt for your meal? Really, you do? Because you're just going to throw it away when you wash your jeans.
While this was broadcasting live to the audience out here on Michigan Avenue, a guy grabbed his gal and a big old sloppy tongue kiss right in front of me. I see you. Touché is coming up after the 7:30 news. Stay with us. All right, coming up, Touché, after the news. Got a lot to talk about in the political world. Rob Martyr, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. You have a good weekend?
Not too bad. Yeah, happy retirement to my dad, who officially hung it up after, 35, 40 years as a lawyer. Yeah, yeah, did well for himself. So
that's
congratulations,
great, man.
Dad.
That's great. All
yeah,
right.
We had a good time.
We'll talk more about that a little bit later
you
in
bet.
The show. Let's keep the trains running on time.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
You go right, you go right, you go left, you go right, you go right, you go right, you go left, you go right.
It's a download here on 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling. It is time for Touché, where we take a left and right look at national politics, some local as well. Good to see you guys. How are you?
Good to see you, Justin.
I am back from the Hamilton tour.
Oh, yeah? You went and saw Hamilton?
No. We went to all of these incredible Hamilton spots.
Of course.
We went to Weehawken, where Hamilton and Burr ended it for Hamilton. And I got to tell you,
the boring U.S. history part of Hamilton.
Have you ever been to to Weehawken?
No, no.
Have you seen it?
No.
It's unbelievable. It's really amazing, the view you get over there. But we went to his house, family. We went to Francis Tavern, all these Hamilton spots. Morristown, Jockey Hollow.
Wow, that's cool.
So Chris and I were debating before we started, because I said I don't want to hear any of it until I go see the show live. And Chris has now heard all of it backwards and forwards and has memorized the entire show.
Courtesy of my sophomore rising junior son, Charlie.
Yes, he knows all about
it. Oh, man.
Well, let's make a transition to this week's politics.
To contemporary. But wait a minute. I got to tell you something.
Okay.
214 years ago today is the day that Burr and Hamilton had their duel.
Oh, that's topical.
Happy birthday. Or death day.
Happy death day,
I don't know if, something.
Okay, so a lot of unrest in the country this week. Obviously, what happened with protests, the shootings in Dallas of police officers, the continued protest over the weekend, even into today. You know, as we talk about unrest, and there always seems to be politics around it, do you see that this being, I guess, an advantage to one political party or the other?
You know, I obviously Trump is trying to turn it to his advantage. He gave a speech in which he said, "I am the law and order candidate 100%." And he's trying to, you know, pull. He has been doing things out of the Nixon playbook from 1968. And I've been saying that on this show for months and months, right back to when they had that event ill-placed in Chicago in March. He wants to create, and I'm not saying he's creating the atmosphere in the country. Real events are happening. They're horrible events. But he's trying to leverage that. And I don't think that it's going to play out for him the way that he thinks it will.
He doesn't really have anything to lose because the African-American vote wasn't going for Donald Trump anyway, right?
Well, this is just a Democrat turnout ploy. And that's all Black Lives Matter matters.
Oh, my God.
Is.
Oh,
and that's
my God.
How could you say that, though? That a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, though.
No, I'm not saying that.
But how do you, I mean...
I'm saying that because all they are interested in is racial division.
No.
And I say this in general. There are pockets. I even posted this beautiful video of this Black Lives Matter group and this kind of biker group coming together down in Texas today. It was really great. I commend it to everybody's attention. So there are great people who inhabit Black Lives Matter, but there's a lot of cancerous rhetoric, but it is the Democrat. David talks about, he wants to raise racism from the Nixon era. I'm going to raise the phony church burning scandals of the
90s. Actually, I didn't say raise the racism. I said raise the law and order stuff from the Nixon era.
And
the silent majority.
Chris, we're talking about here is something that actually statistically doesn't really exist. And if they cared about Black Lives, they'd be concerned about all the people
who are
being shot in Chicago.
No, but there's a difference, though, because...
No, there's no difference.
There is a difference.
There
Chris.
Is no difference
there
between
absolutely
some kid
is.
In Chicago who's killed...
They're different issues.
Cop.
Why can't they be different issues? There's a
because the
way the police have treated African Americans for centuries, for
that
decades,
is bad.
Is bad.
We understand.
But what I'm saying,
that's
what
the
protest
cops understand
is about.
That every one of these big city police departments is run by a Democratic mayor and a Democrat commissioner,
but
and
that's
a Democrat
why it's not
city
politics.
Council.
What I'm saying is,
it is politics.
It isn't politics because the Black Lives Matter movement went against Bernie Sanders. And against Hillary Clinton. There has been. You'll see what happens in Philadelphia. That I don't think they're going to choose one party or another. They're going to get their voice heard from authorities.
Oh, yeah, they are. Oh, yeah, they are.
I don't think that this is some sort of...
what Justin said, and look, it is so offensive to me, Chris, every single time you say that this is a political movement, a George Soros-funded political movement that's designed to increase Democratic turnout. Black Lives Matter started because black black people who were either unarmed or were not using arms or were lying down on the ground like Laquan McDonald and shot 16 times, got sick and tired of having this stuff happen against them.
Who
it
came
is
out
not
for
a creation
Who,
of the Democratic movement. It is not a creation.
Who came out for Rahm to step down from office because of covering up Laquan McDonald? Not you.
Yeah,
not
actually,
you. Me. Okay, I was on the Laquan McDonald before you ever said a word about it. So don't talk to me about Laquan McDonald.
And no,
and I want to tell you something. Every person out there in America understands that cops have to be held to a higher standard, and that cops should not use deadly force unless absolutely necessary. Everybody understands that, and the times that they fall short are horrible.
Right,
and sometimes it's because of racism, but not always. Okay, and
agreed.
And the propensity on for black officers or for officers are killed at a higher rate by African American offenders than they are other racial
Chris, this
group.
Is the only problem I have with the way that this conversation is going is it always seems to transition out of the political ramifications, is what we're talking about here in Touche, and into what we just don't know. We're white guys
who
are doing a segment.
But
my point being that the political story here, the one that you threw out, the premise, that's what we're arguing. The idea that somehow this is a hatched up thing to drive voter turnout for Democrats is really flimsy. And that
I don't think that's flimsy
okay,
at all.
Okay.
Look, despite everything, despite every one of his ridiculous statements, despite every one of his crazy self-referential errors, Donald Trump is still in many polls within the margin of error with Hillary Clinton.
And what does this have to do with Black Lives Matter being somehow an invention?
The Democrats are desperate about black turnout.
Dave, let me
ask you. They're not desperate about black turnout. I got to tell you, Chris, the one thing Democrats are not worried about is black turnout. There is no greater turnout machine for Democrats, for blacks and Latinos and women, than Donald J. Trump himself. And everybody I know, every political person I know in the Democratic Party is 100% confident of that fact.
Let me ask you guys this about
my experience. I have Democrats pulling me aside at parties saying, he is going to get a vote in the black community that you will not believe. And I say, why? And they say, because
that.
He is talking about jobs and Hillary isn't.
Oh, she is. And you got to stop smoking that hopium, Chris. That is a complete fantasy. And I will bet you on this air right now that Donald Trump's turnout in the black vote will be no higher than 5-6% max.
I'll take that bet.
Done.
I
love it.
Put up
all right.
Your
let's take a break.
Hamilton.
Let's take a break.
Flat chance.
Let's take a break here on Touche, and we'll come back and let's talk about the conventions. They're coming up next week. We'll talk about whether or not we will see political unrest with protests out front, but also vice presidents. I mean, it's got to be this week, right? I mean, this is the week that
it's the week for the Donald.
This is where it's got to be, at least for Donald Trump. We'll continue the conversation.
Newt.
Chris
Newt.
Roebling and Dave Lundy here on the download. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche. You go right,
you go right. Touche here on the download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio. We'll continue our conversation here. Protests are the topic. Talk about the conventions. Both here comes the RNC in Cleveland next week. Philadelphia the week after for the DNC. There's already been planned protests for both conventions. The unrest that we're seeing in the country now, do we feel that it's going to bolster protests at both of the conventions?
I think there's going to be a lot of protesting at the Republican convention because the Democrats, just like here in Chicago, want to provoke some kind of conflict.
No, we don't. In fact, I would urge every Democrat listening to my voice, don't protest in Cleveland.
They're not going to be listening to David because they know what their orders are.
You actually
above.
Like the concept of,
he loves
of
it.
Provoking protests at the convention because it's more.
No, I think the protest that I'm looking for at the convention, and I don't know if you guys saw this just a few days ago, a couple of guys have done a polling of the entire Republican delegates, and the hard Trump people number about maybe 800 to 825 or something like that. There are other people who are nominally pledged to Trump, but they're disappointed with how with how he has been doing. And I think there's a possibility of folks actually taking a look at this. Now,
I mean, that's good. Let me ask this question to both of you guys.
I would love it.
You've been doing it for years. Is there any chance we see some history coming out of this convention where Donald Trump runs into some trouble before he's nominated?
No. And look, Chris and I have been having this argument for months now. I've told him that his nominee was set. It was done. They're pledged. They're not opening it up. I will be shocked, absolutely stunned if that happens. You've also been saying for months, and I have to call
you
on this.
You've got
to
call me on
it. I have to call you on this.
I know.
Chris has been saying that Hillary Clinton would not be the nominee. Chris, can we get you on the air now to admit that the nominee of the Democratic Party will be Hillary Rodham Clinton?
So sad to say it.
I haven't heard you say it.
I'm really sorry about it. I'm hoping.
Let me ask about
for an outbreak of sanity.
I've noticed this obviously the Republican convention will garner protests because of Trump and the style. But it's a Democrat convention in Philadelphia. I mean, you think about some of the protests that have happened at the Democrat side, even in history here in Chicago. But we also saw it in Los Angeles in 2000. Like, do you think that protesters will bring the heat at the DNC side as well?
I do. I do think there will be a lot of protests at the Democratic convention. What will be interesting is that the Democrats will be protesting the Republican convention and the Democratic convention.
They're going to be busy 2 weeks.
It'll be a busy 2 weeks for them. Look, I'm going to the convention. I'm looking forward to it. I'm really excited about nominating the first woman to head a major party ticket. I think we're going to have a great convention. I have no idea what they're going to do in Cleveland because Trump was supposed to release his list of speakers a week and a half ago.
Still hasn't.
We're still waiting. All we know for sure
there's
is that his wife and his kids are going to speak. And Mike Dick does not. He declined. And Mike Tyson, who he wanted to speak, apparently there was a quota on rapists. So Mike Tyson will not
all
be
right,
speaking.
Chris, let me ask you about how this has all been set up when we talk about conventions. Would there have been some talk about Donald Trump speaking, you know, they walked him off of that ledge in the way that he was going to speak it every day, which was different. Talk about the balance between Trump breaking the system and the order of an RNC.
There are indications that Trump may be announcing of his vice presidential choice even tomorrow. There are indications. I don't know that, and I don't know who it's going to be. But
Newt.
I do know
Newt.
I don't think it's going to be Newt, but I think that he is getting close to that. And that's a big prelude because you make the announcement and then you tour together with whoever.
For a week.
And then they go out and they do a few events together and speak and always try to get on the same wavelength.
Well, that's the conventional approach. Do you think Trump's going to do that?
I think that actually is going to be done. And there are a variety of folks he's looking at, some of whom, for instance, governors, specifically the governor from Indiana, Mike Pence, who has been mentioned many times. Especially
he met with
him
a couple weeks ago. Yeah.
Yeah. 24 hours, 48 hours. He's come up a lot. They've got big political operations and the Trump political operation right now is not a very big or very sophisticated or very well running political operation. So I think this is a fascinating, just if all of that happens, but I do think you will see a move by folks. Now I know the Rules Committee and I know the RNC doesn't want it. And I know there are folks out there who are pledged against, et cetera, et cetera. I think there are folks who want to be heard. And Paul Ryan as chairman of the convention, is going to have to make a decision. Do we let this go forward? Do we have that voiced on our floor and give voice to both sides? Or are we going to bottle it up and just act like there's no big deal and proceed from there? I hope he lets the conversation evolve.
I heard crazy rumors at the end of last week that Ivanka Trump, the daughter of
Donald,
was a consideration for vice president.
Come on.
I know. That's what I said, too. But everything's been come on for the last 6 months.
Right. Except there is a constitutional provision that says you can't have the
all right, good. That's what
president
I want to hear.
And vice president from the same state.
All right. There we go.
No, what I'm curious, actually, I'd like to ask Chris a question.
Please go ahead.
Chris,
so
what do you make of the fact that Donald Trump, after promising that he would not allow anybody to speak who did not endorse him, asked Ted Cruz to speak without requiring an endorsement?
Welcome to Trumpland. I mean, we're living in Obama land with all of this racial hatred and animosity and all these terrible things going on.
You can't control yourself, can you, man?
I'm just reporting as it is, man. I'll tell you.
All right,
but
quick,
no, Trump land, he says one thing and does another.
We only got 2 minutes left.
It's kind of like
Obama.
Do
you have speculation on who the vice presidential candidate would be for both candidates, for Trump and Clinton?
I think that Trump is going to try to surprise people. He does not like whatever the most conventional wisdom is, so he will do something different. He tried with the general over the weekend, and that didn't work out so well when he was interviewed by ABC, said he was pro-choice, and then there was a hubbub, and then within 24 hours he said, oh, I meant I'm pro-life. That didn't go over so well. Yeah, that wasn't a great moment for him, his vice presidential
pick. We heard Pence. Who else?
Newt Gingrich and Chris Christie are still being talked about.
I think Christie and Pence are the ones probably at this point. I think Gingrich is actually a personal friend of Trump's. They've known each other for 20, 25 years. They are in touch a lot in the offseason, so to speak. And so I think that you're looking at Gingrich probably wants to play a very big role and probably look for a cabinet job or something like that.
Democrats, quick.
Democrats, I'm going to stick with Tim Kaine. I think it's
boring.
I'm sorry. They're doubling down on boring.
I think Tim Kaine is actually a fascinating guy, and he's got a lot to say, and he's a mayor. He's a former mayor of Richmond.
And a governor.
And Tim Kaine is the kind of guy most Republicans would sort of feel like, well, at least he's not as bad as some of these folks like Elizabeth Warren.
I think that's what Democrats and Bernie Sanders don't like. They don't like that you're going with a pick for the vice president that would go.
Bernie Sanders is endorsing Hillary Clinton.
That's probably why they did the budget. Why Hillary did the budget busting college proposal.
All right. We'll leave that there.
Oi.
Dave Lundy.
Chris you're
Roman.
Killing me, man.
Does you got a way to pay for that?
Well, Roebling's figured out the timing of this segment.
That?
He knows it's live. He waits till the last 10 seconds and he throws something in that can't be challenged.
Thank you.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, Touche. Thanks for being here, guys. Next week.
See you next week.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up tonight, the Pitchfork Music Festival kicks off this weekend. We've got some awesome musicians in studio coming up at 9 o'clock. The local band Twin Peaks will be here. These guys grew up in the Rogers Park area. They are huge right now. I mean, they're all over the country. They were just on Conan O'Brien maybe a week ago, week and a half ago. They are one of the bands at Pitchfork Music Fest. They played so many festivals over the years. When I say that, I also mentioned that they're 23 years old, 24 years old. But they are here in studio tonight, so we'll be talking with the guys from Twin Peaks. Also, live performance tonight in Studio 435 with the band Whitney, another great band that used to be two of the guys from Smith Westerns. Now the band Whitney is blowing up, and they also are playing Pitchfork. So we're going to have a lot of music this week just because a lot of the bands that are coming through to Pitchfork, and it's awesome to have that festival here in Chicago because we can get the bands to talk about their lives. There you go. So that's coming up a little bit later in the show tonight. Well, if you were at the 4th of July parade in Aurora just this past weekend, you may have seen my next guest. He was the Grand Marshal. Tim Rader is the president and CEO of the Paramount Theater in Aurora. Rader is no stranger to regional theater. He was the head over at the Metropolis Performing Arts Center in Arlington Heights. The Paramount Theater has done some great stuff in the last few years, whether it be the Christmas Story they did over the Christmas time or their Broadway series. It's clear that the gamble to bring the Paramount to life just a mere 5 years ago has worked. The theater is serving as a beacon, as a centerpiece for a town that is constantly competing to keep people at home. Tim Rader is my guest tonight at the big table. Tim, good to see you.
Justin, I'm so thrilled to be here, man. This is great. I'm excited.
Congrats on all your success. I mean, we've known each other for a long time, and it's amazing to see not only being the Grand Marshal of the parade, but there's articles about you. You got a key to the city kind of thing. Like you're like Mr. Aurora now.
I feel like the most famous person in my subdivision. It's pretty exciting. Yeah. And, I might be the youngest Grand Marshal of the 4th of July parade in Aurora. It's pretty exciting. And I wasn't alone. I was with Jim Cordy, and he's been a big part of the success of the Paramount.
He's the
artistic director.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about Broadway series is really what what is pushing you guys. You made a decision to do a series of bringing Broadway musicals to Aurora. That's been a big part of the success of the Paramount. Talk about it.
Yeah. You know, when I was hired, the board really wanted to see some more activity. That's what we'd done at the Metropolis and Arlington Heights. We're doing over 400 performances a year, just cramming them into the theater. Just activity. And they saw that. They saw the track record of that. So when I first got there, you know, one of the things that I took a look at was what was working in at the Paramount, what was selling, what people wanted to see. We started kicking the can on, you know, do we try to do our own thing, our own Paramount Broadway series? You know, we'd had these tours that came through, and they didn't sell very well. It was like, you know, The Drowsy Chaperone and The Wizard of Oz.
And when you say tour, like just a theater that is just, or someone who's just producing this going from town to town to town.
Exactly. So the actors come in on a bus, and the set comes in on a semi, and they stay for one, two, maybe three shows. And ticket prices are pretty pricey because those tours cost a lot of money, and the show's kind of okay. You know, maybe mediocre, maybe good sometimes, but most of the time not so much. And so when we started looking at what was working and what wasn't, we needed to make a decision. Do we want theater, musical theater, to be a part of what we do at the Paramount in addition to the other things we do, or do we not, because it didn't quite work the way it was? And so we looked at different things, and what we ended up settling on was producing our own shows and hiring our own directors, hiring our own actors, you know, having professional musicians and building our own sets, doing our own costumes, picking our own shows. And that's, you know, it was a big decision that the board took a huge leap of faith on to.
Yeah, because, I mean, I would think even though it's pricey to the tickets to the people who are coming in, a touring show ultimately is going to be more inexpensive, or at least a more of a value, because you don't have to put that much capital or at least muscle into, or creative muscle into, the project.
Absolutely. Like a tour, it may be $25,000 plus expenses to put on a particular performance, but you know, if you're producing a show, I mean, our budgets are, you know, $1.5 million for a production, approximately. A little more, a little less, depending on what we're doing. And it's a huge investment that you really need some sort of, I guess, faith that people will come see the show. And that faith for us comes from subscribers. We really believe in the subscription model. And from the beginning, we wanted to be one of the largest theater subscription bases in the nation. And right now we're look like we're on track to be about 35,000 subscribers this coming season.
Wow.
Which is the third largest subscription base in the nation.
I mean, to put that in perspective, I mean, a lot of theaters want to do that as well. I mean, you think of Chicago. Yeah. I mean, that's the model that's done. To get that many, that 35,000 people who are on your subscription list at a theater in Aurora, that's huge.
Right. One of the farthest western suburbs in a town that does not have a history of a professional theater company in its midst, it was proof. You know, the fact that the community has responded so well, and they always have from the very beginning when we first rolled out this idea, the city of Aurora, and not just Aurora, but all the surrounding communities to Aurora, have just supported and gravitated and continued to tell their friends and neighbors about what we're doing. We tried from the beginning just really to pick shows they wanted to see and do them at a price point that folks could afford to come. You know, that subscription model is not dead, and people talk about it all the time. Oh,
right.
Subscription's dead.
Or they're trying to come up with something new to
something flex, flex model or whatever, you know, or a discount here if you buy enough seats and maybe get some autographed toilet paper or something like that. Who knows? You know, it's like all this crazy gimmicks that they do that just don't work. It's, you just need to pick a show, do it well, and get people a value. And so we do a buy two shows, get two shows free. So you, the most expensive subscription you can get this next year is, gosh, it's $120. So
how do you pick the shows? I mean, obviously to pick a show to tour is one thing, but to produce a show, to actually put it up and find cast, what's the process to find the right Broadway musical?
It really is a process. It's talking with the licensing companies to find out what product is available. We have the ability to produce shows that aren't on tour, so we find out what's not touring, what's available for us to actually produce. We have to, you know, make sure that nobody else in the Chicago market's already got the license for the show, and then we talk about what we think would be the best fit for our season. Obviously, we want to pick shows that the audience wants to see. We need to sell tickets.
So what do you got? What are the four this?
This season, this is part of the reason it's going to be such a big season. We got Mamma Mia, which is the regional premiere of Mamma Mia. We've had the tour through town, right? We're the first people in the Chicago market to be able to produce Mamma Mia, and that's a huge coup.
That's huge. Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to have 100,000 people come see Mamma Mia in Aurora. You know, it's fantastic. And you know, 85% of those people don't live in Aurora. These are people from outside of the, you know, it's a huge boon to the downtown. And, you know, and so that's twice as many people coming to see Mamma Mia that we used to have 50,000 people come to the Paramount on an annual basis. And now we have twice that coming to one production. It's pretty great. And then we have Little Mermaid for the holidays that opens up Thanksgiving weekend and runs through New Year's. And then we have Sweeney Todd. So if you mm-hmm. like a little bit of Sondheim, a little meat pie or the sort, you know, it's going to be a fun one. Always happy, lots of grins. And the final show of the season is Jesus Christ Superstar.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Tim Rader is the president and CEO of the Paramount Theater in Aurora. We'll take a break. He's my guest tonight at the Big Table. We come back, we'll talk about, I'd love to get your thoughts on theater as a tool for redevelopment. You know, obviously the Paramount being a place that where it's located in Aurora, you've had success with that in Arlington Heights, but there seems to be a movement to try and get theaters to be centerpieces of at least towns as opposed to cities. We'll talk about that coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Tim Rader. Tim Rader is the president and CEO of Paramount Theater in Aurora, Illinois. We're talking about the success of Paramount, which has been, I mean, it's been, I mean, there's been articles all about your success for this. I mean, you're surprised at the way that the Chicago media market has responded to the success that you've had in Aurora?
It has been a little bit of a shock, and it's interesting when I get calls for advice on how to do programming for theaters in Ohio or Michigan or someplace that might be opening up, and they're looking for programming models, and now they're looking to what we're doing at the Paramount is kind of an example of how to actually bring people to their city and bring people from outside of their city to them, to their core to stimulate the economy.
Let's talk about your life in theater. I mean, I mentioned the Metropolis. When you got out of college, was the goal to run a theater? What was your passion coming out of
yeah,
school?
I got out of college. Actually, I have a degree in business management and another in acting and theater. And I've always loved theater, but I never actually thought I would be an actor because I grew up on a farm and we were very, very poor in Iowa. And I guess I just didn't want to be poor the rest of my life. So when I came to Chicago, I actually went into restaurant management for a couple years, really hated my life. And my wife, girlfriend at the time, now we're married, she's like, just make a change. And so I took a job as a box office manager at Apple Tree Theater in Highland Park.
And, yeah.
And was there 9 months and was asked to go open the Metropolis. The managing director there said, hey, I'm going to go open the Metropolis Performing Arts Center. I want you to come with. I want you to be the general manager there. And I said, that sounds great. I really think this is an opportunity. And that's where it started. And it really was all about what made sense, you know, as far as what we could sell and what would bring people to the theater that would make them want to come back.
Well, this would have been around 2000, yeah, that kind
exactly.
of time. And
yeah.
And this is when Arlington Heights really made that initiative as a town to redevelop their downtown. They started bringing in restaurants. They brought the Metropolis. They built some new buildings. Talk about what it was like to be a part of not just running a theater, but being part of a resurgence or redevelopment of a downtown.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. We just had this downtown city council meeting in Aurora where the mayor of Arlington Heights came and spoke on behalf of what change has happened in Arlington Heights.
Yeah.
And how she'll drive around downtown and she'll see children from the School of Performing Arts eating their bag lunches out in the park right in the middle of downtown Arlington Heights. And, yeah, we were a part of that. We were a part of bringing people and pride to a community, which is really what it's all about, having that good PR, sense of community, the belonging, and it was a whole experience. The people that go to the theater, they also, as you know, they dine, they buy clothes, they pay the babysitter, they buy gas, and there's transport costs and hotel sometimes, and all of this other spending that goes along with a ticket to a show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, and then you go to the show and you have all these memories, and you want to come back if you do a good show, if they think it's a good value.
What did you learn from your time in Arlington Heights? Because obviously, I mean, running a theater, especially in a redevelopment of downtown, there's a risk involved. There's some shows that work, some that don't. Exactly. What did you learn that you took with you to the Paramount?
That's an excellent question. You have to do a show that people want to see. That's number one. You have to pick a show that someone wants to see. And then it's got to be a good show. And if you're going to take a risk on a show, it better be a damn good show, because that risk is you only get so many of them before you close your doors. You've got to pick stuff that works, stuff like Schadenfreude for all that. I mean, all the great, great shows and Second City and these Christmas carols, and some of those things support the other, maybe more adventurous types of shows that you want to do. You know, it's stuff like that that really it's a part of a bigger picture, a whole package. You need different types of programming for different audiences. You need concerts and comedians. But at the end of the day, you have to pick shows that people want to see. And then after they see them, they have to want to come back.
Well, one of the things about a downtown theater, and you had this at Metropolis and you asked it at Paramount as well, is being able to balance the space with your traditional theater productions and be able to program off theater, meaning, you know, concerts, comedians, Air Supply, that kind of thing.
Right.
But you have to. It's not just a job of opening night where you're putting up the lights and stuff. You really have to think about the shows that are going to work outside of live theater.
And what we found is there was this fear when we started doing these long runs of Broadway musicals that people would stop coming to the other shows. It's just been the opposite. People that are becoming subscribers to the Paramount Broadway series, they're part of the family, and they're now single ticket buyers to Jay Leno or Frank Caliendo, whoever it may be that we're having. They're now coming back because they have this relationship with us. They know where to park. You know, we started right after I started, we started this Classic Movie Mondays. It's $1. You can come see The Goonies or Casablanca or something like that in downtown Aurora, big screen, big theater, really quality experience for a buck. And the popcorn in the movie, the popcorn and the soda is like half price what you would have at a normal theater. Mm-hmm. But this is just a community building tool. It's to bring people downtown so they have a relationship with their downtown, with the Paramount. Perhaps they go to eat before or after the show. They see what else we're doing at the Paramount. They decide they want to come back and see something else.
As colloquial or corny as it sounds, but it is a community center in the way that, it is something that is that almost roots the community.
And brings them together. Yeah. Exactly. It's the heart of Aurora, where this has now been such a source of pride. And I feel that from my neighbors, from the people I work with downtown, from the mayor. I mean, talk about support. I mean, without the board and the mayor and this group, this community, this wouldn't have happened. There's 100 different things that could have gone wrong. And I'm grateful every day that they haven't. So many things. And it's a blessing to be in the community that we're in, because we couldn't have had the support just anywhere.
What did you know about Aurora before? I mean, you're working in Arlington Heights. What did you know about Aurora? What did you know about the Paramount? What drew you to this job?
To be honest, it was an opportunity. I saw what they were doing and I really felt like I could help. It felt like a community that needed maybe just a little more of a boost. There was clearly economic opportunity downtown, and that's changing. We've had a few restaurants open since.
What was there before you guys took 5 years ago?
Well, the casino, Hollywood Casino, is downtown, mm-hmm. and the Paramount's there. And Paramount was doing by most standards, they were doing really a good job with their programming. They had lots of stuff coming through. But it was 45 to 50 different performances. Now we're doing 300 performances, and that's not even including what we're doing at River Edge Park, just up the river half a mile. So it's a whole different deal. Rather than 50,000 people coming through per year, it's well over 300.
But if someone's listening right now to WGN Radio, lives in Chicago, never made their way out to Aurora, what was Aurora like before you came in with the 300, 400 set? Where the Paramount was already working, was already a viable theater, it was working, it just wasn't working at the volume.
Right.
But talk about what you saw when you first got there. What was downtown Aurora like?
It needed help. There was not a lot of, there is no retail. There is no, no real nightlife. There was nothing really to do besides go to the casino. And it was suffering a little bit. And it's changing, and it's really changing quickly. And it's remarkable the amount of enthusiasm there is right now for development in downtown Aurora. including this new performing arts center, Aurora Arts Center, that actually looks like it's happening right next to the theater. It's a $35 million development that there's going to be a school of performing arts, a new restaurant, apartments, artists' preferred lofts. It's exciting. It's a really exciting thing to see. And the nicest thing is it's really, we can tell it's just the beginning of the economic activity. It's just the beginning. And it's really exciting to witness, because when I showed up, you know, I remember talking to a staff member that was coming to, is actually Jim Jarvis. He was, you know, when he was deciding to come and work, he talked to me about how his brother told him, are you going to, you know, bring your gun with you to work? And that's just not been my experience. I've never been to Aurora or work. I work there. I live there. I play there. And I've never had an experience where I felt unsafe. It's really, the downtown is as safe as a downtown can be.
Well, it's a huge community that's growing, too. I mean, Aurora in the last 10 years has you know, sort
it's
of
exploded.
Been, it's exploded. It's become what, the second largest city in
it is, yeah.
in
over
Illinois.
200,000 yeah. people. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot happening in Aurora. We're talking with Tim Rader. He's the CEO and president of the Paramount Theater in Aurora, Illinois. We're talking about regional theater. We're talking about what you've done in the last 5 years, and also about redeveloping a downtown through the arts. We'll continue the conversation here on the download. Let's get a break for the news. We'll come back. We'll talk more with Tim. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight in studio, Tim Rader, president and CEO of the Paramount Theater in Aurora, Illinois, a longtime friend of mine. Tim, it's good to see you. It's good to see you having success out in Aurora. You know, not every time does that happen. You know, theaters have long been, and theaters and art centers and music venues, they've long been the source of a redevelopment of a downtown. And it almost feels like a crapshoot when it comes to which ones succeed and which ones don't. We see it even in this, in our the towns that are in this area, from the North Shore towns to other towns have tried things in the south suburbs. Why does it work in Aurora?
Wow, that's a complicated question. I think it comes down to their philosophy on programming in a lot of ways, their leadership. It's always baffled me to see a big, beautiful theater, any theater for that matter, just to sit empty. I just don't understand that. I don't understand why folks that run them can't be a little more creative about what they do and find a way to fill them.
You see that in Chicago neighborhoods. I mean, we've been struggling over, renovating the Uptown Theater for ages. I mean, that's a money issue to try and get that off the ground. But you see it, I mean, almost all of the old suburban areas of this town, they'll have that downtown theater, that might be dormant.
Yeah, and some of these towns, they tear them down and turn them into parking lots. I just can't wrap my brain around it. You know, if they just had the right vision for the theater and the right programming model, they can do, I mean, performing arts centers, they're in the center of the downtown for a reason. These theaters, they're economic stimuluses and they're a source of pride, and they bring people to the city. Like I said before, you know, the Paramount bringing in these folks, 85% of them are from outside of Aurora.
Well, I mean, how much is it? I mean, this is a difficult question, but I mean, just in terms of comprehend on my part, but you know, how much of it is that you're just far enough outside of Chicago? Like if I'm thinking of theaters that might be more in the inner circle of, you know, 15, 20 minutes away from a downtown Chicago, that those theaters may not be worth a resurgence because people have already made up their mind to easily commute into downtown Chicago. For you to be an hour plus out, is that an advantage?
Oh, I don't know. I don't actually know if a distance makes too much of a difference. I think that there's theaters in the burbs like Drury Lane and Oak Brook and Marion and Lincolnshire. They're right in the middle, you know, kind of 30 miles out each way, and we're 45. And so they're having a lot of success with their musical theater models. The Marriott's the largest subscription base in the nation for now, or second largest, I should say. And, you know, there are theaters. I mean, the density of population here is just so tremendous. And I don't think that we're oversaturated with theaters. And I think people that want to go to downtown Chicago for the downtown Chicago experience, that's one thing. If they want to see a show, that's another thing. They could see it anywhere. I think Chicago is a very unique experience. It's an exciting experience. You can come here for the whole package, the dinner, the show, sometimes the night in the hotel. And, you know, and we have the same thing. It's just a different option. If you don't want to drive downtown, here's an option right here in the western suburbs. And there's theaters all in between that have that same option. And some of them are more successful than others.
Do you consider yourself at the Paramount, do you consider yourself part of the Chicago theater scene?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We you know, when we are looking for titles for shows, it's, you know, we are part of the Chicago market. We're competing against, you know, the Goodman and Chicago Shakespeare and Marriott and Drury Lane and all these folks in Broadway and Chicago, the tours that come through. We right now, we look at Broadway and Chicago as our main competition, to be honest. They're the biggest titles that come through Chicago, and we want to be the big dog in town. We want to be the largest theater in town, and I think we're well on our way to doing that.
Can you, are you in a position where you can compete for titles with Broadway and Chicago? I mean, they obviously have these relationships with Broadway, and you see it when, whether it be SpongeBob or any of the other theaters, Book of Mormon, Hamilton, those kind of things. Do you see a future in which Paramount can compete for sort of,
well,
the hot titles?
They get the titles first, no matter what. That's Broadway and Chicago, because they're doing the first run Broadway tours. They always have dibs on Book of Mormon and Wicked's and all of those shows that come through. They will always have first dibs. So we have to do the very best that we can with the other titles. And what we do is we produce them in a way that people can experience them, and they're better than they were before. They're re-envisioned shows that people can experience in their community.
Do you see yourself, you know, obviously the Broadway musical is working in Aurora. Do you see yourself, as you talk about trying to differentiate or diversify your content, being a house for something else? Being a house for, this is going to be the house that brings you original drama, original comedy, like that kind of stuff. I mean, is there a way for you to diversify, to continue what you've done with the Broadway series in other genres?
You know, we just hired Amber Mack. She's our new musical development director, and that's an investment into doing new musicals in the years to come. And it's going to take a few seasons, but we do see a future there. We see a show being created for the first time and featured, the world premiere at the Paramount Theater. And we will likely put it as part of our subscription series. And it will be, we hope, embraced and loved and then taken to Broadway, and it will live forever. That's our hope. And we don't know why we couldn't do that. Other people have the same success. So that's the direction we're heading. And I think ultimately that's probably the best way we can compete, is just to continue to produce the very best shows we can, start working on new works, because we think that's the real future, partner with producers that want to be a part of these new works. They're already bringing titles to us. We're already talking about, we were at a reading earlier today for a new musical. It's an exciting prospect to think about how we could then create something from scratch at the Paramount that will live forever, something for our families and our children to cherish, something that could actually have some sort of emotional response forever and not just for 6 weeks, the 6 week run that we're having at the Paramount Theater, something that could live for always.
Well, I mean, talking to Tim Rader, he's the CEO and president at the Paramount Theater in Aurora, Illinois. You know, the one thing that regional theater, suburban theater, even community theater has to deal with is that stereotype of the waiting for Guffman. Like the idea that you're sticking, sort of like the stigma of, we are going to do it, we're going to put on a play, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, all right. But, I mean, is that a real thing? I mean, do people kind of hold their nose up on the fact that you're not downtown Chicago, that you're doing new, looking to do new works in Aurora?
I'm sure it happens. But I tell you what, I know it's happening less and less, especially this last year when it was our first year of eligibility for the Jeff Awards, which is the Chicago version of the Tonys, as you know. And we were nominated for 16 Jeff nominations, and we took home 5, including the best large musical and production, as well as best direction and some other things. We're doing, I believe, the very best musical theater in Chicago right now. We're producing huge Broadway scale musicals in a Broadway caliber house. We're bigger than most Broadway theaters. And we're doing it in a way that really taps into the core emotion of each production and really is resonating with people. And we know it's resonating with people because the subscriptions are just skyrocketing. We started off the first season with 12,500, and over the course of, this is going to be our sixth season, we're going to be, you know, the third largest subscription
base. And the reason that we're talking, I mean, and to put it plainly, I mean, you just don't see that kind of success in the business model that is theater. I mean, you will see others have success, and you'll have hits on your hand. But when you're talking about regional theater, you know, downtown Aurora theater, right, you're not seeing that kind of growth. And I think that that's why you're a case study. That's why there's texts that are coming in saying they love what you're doing in Aurora, or they want to be in touch with you because they want to find out about how they can do it in their town. So it really is trying to unlock the secret for why this is working, why the Paramount is working in Aurora, where it may not be working in other towns.
You know, I think a lot of it is the people that have come to play at the Paramount. It's really a tremendously gifted group of individuals. Jim Cordy, the designers. And when you ask me whether we think we're a part of the Chicago market, absolutely we are. We're working with the very best designers, the directors, the actors. They're all Chicago. This is the best of Chicago. And they're wanting to be at the Paramount Theater. I remember when Chris Jones asked me if I knew that we were I think he called it the blue ticket to work. It was like the place for the actor. Every actor wanted to work at the Paramount. And I just thought that was so incredibly flattering, that this is where we allow people to do their very best work. The designers get to really do what they want, and they get to collaborate. And the scenic designer can have a say in what the costume designer is thinking, and vice versa. It's really a tremendously collaborative environment. And that's something Jim Cordy has made possible from the beginning. He allows me to come in into the tech process and say, have you thought about doing this? And he'll think about it and he'll use it. Sometimes he'll slap me and say, are you stupid? But no, I'm kidding. It's not, but it's really that sort of group. There's no toxic energy, you know, from marketing to development to, we have all of these tremendously talented people that just want to do their best work. And the box office, the ushers, it's a unique experience. It's very special, and I only see it getting stronger. The community has been everything. They've supported it from day one.
Well, I'll ask you about, in any business, there are going to be products that soar, and there's going to be products that fail. Right. In theater, are you in a position, are you at a vantage point of the Paramount Theater where, let's say that you put out a show tomorrow, and it's something where you invest in a new musical, and it's that show we've been talking about that nobody wants to see.
Right.
You know, that's are scary. You in a position at not unlike, you know, or unlike a lot of different theaters where you can survive, you know, a risky show, a show that might not be successful?
That's a really good question. I worry about all the shows that we pick, and I worry that they're going to sell. A new musical, we were just talking about this tonight, about how can we best introduce this? When's the right time? It's about what other shows we can surround it with. You know, if we have a Wicked in our season, yeah, we can do a new musical and anchor it with the other shows and that surround it. So we have to be very careful about what we do and how we pick that first new musical and how we nurture it. So it is received well and we don't lose our butts on it if we end up, you know, not being able to sell tickets to it. And the most important thing at the end of the day about this new musical is we have to be passionate about it. We have to know that it's something, regardless of whether it sells tickets or not, we're doing it for the right reason, because we believe it has the right voice for us, the Paramount and the community that we want to share with the world. And gosh, now's a good time to be doing something like that, something that could really have a message.
Well, it's a good place to go. I mean, obviously, to be a regional theater, to be involved in what it's just been 5 years for you, to be the centerpiece for a town like Aurora, it really plays to place, where we live, why we live, where we do. Throwing that at you, asking the question, like, you know, when you think about that being something to a town, a town that maybe before a couple years ago was struggling, what does that make, how does it make you feel to be a part of something that seems to be on the uptick?
Wow. You know, when I was told I was going to be the Grand Marshal, I shared this with Cordy, because he was also Jim Cordy. He's going to be the Grand Marshal as well. And his response to me was really just all for doing our job, you know, and some days that's how it feels. I feel like I get all of this support and all of this warm embrace, and it's really just from doing my job. It feels that way sometimes. And it's a remarkable thing that I think that we're doing. I do think it is going to be a case study in how to rebuild a downtown. But we certainly didn't do it alone. I mean, the mayor and the city council and the board and the community itself, there's so many different little things that could have derailed what we were doing. So I'm not surprised when other communities can't get to where we are, and it is a very unique situation that I think that we're in, because so many little things could have just taken us right off the path. Overpricing, you know, an accident on stage where an actor got hurt. It could be so many tiny little things that we've just been so fortunate to dodge these random bullets. And the little things that we have encountered, we've been able to take heed and adjust. And at the end of the day, we've tried to remove any barrier for someone that wants to come see a show at the Paramount Theater. We want them there so they can experience it and come back.
Tim Rader is the president and CEO of the Paramount Theater in Aurora, Illinois. The Broadway series kicks off this fall. You can check it out, ParamountTheater.com. Is that the...
ParamountAurora.com. Yep.
ParamountAurora.com. Tim, thanks for being my guest tonight. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin. You're the best.
I was bummed, Pete, because I was asked to be on John Williams' podcast, Mincing Rascals, last week. I think I was filling in for Christa McQuarrie. And I had to bail because of my AC.
That's right. And yeah, that stinks.
They tape it super early, you mm-hmm. know, like they do the podcast.
For our schedule.
For our schedule. Yeah. I guess it's normal for yeah. everybody else's schedule.
Midday.
I'm like, it's 11 o'clock? How dare you? Have some respect. No, but then, yeah, if you're a listener to The Download, you know that my AC unit went on the fritz Thursday night, so I had to have the guy come out with the window from Four Seasons. I mean, I learned a ton about AC.
It's worth it.
You know, ask me about a capacitor, and I'll tell you that I know what one is.
What is one?
It's a thing that, yeah, yeah they blow, and then that happens, you got to get them fixed. That's it. That's what I learned.
Are you an air conditioning guy, or, you know, because, like, sometimes some people don't like the cool yeah. air. They like the windows open and they have fans and whatnot.
I'm not. My wife is, and it's kind of obnoxious. It's the one thing I will say that I always get mad, like, whether it's being the car or at home, the air conditioner has to be on. And I always feel like, I don't know what it is. It takes me back to my one bedroom apartment days. You know, when living in Ravenswood, mm-hmm. you know, where you open that window. Maybe you had a unit in the bedroom. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you open that window. And like I said last week, you got a tall boy. You know, that Budweiser tall boy sweating in your hand as you're sitting in the yelling at teenagers down below. Hey, get out of that alley. That was me. Going over to the liquor store to get the cheapest Busch Light that you could.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a big box fan.
It worked.
It
you
worked.
Got through it.
I just, no, it felt so Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It was good times.
I think
it reminded me of good times, Pete.
I was like that. I was like you, but I think I've gotten used to, I need air conditioning at all times. And I see
it's nice.
on these hot days, yeah. I see people with their windows open. And
like today in
my building, which has central air, people with their windows open and like fans going. I don't know if this is like an economic thing, you know, save a little money while you're gone for the day, perhaps. But man, I just love that thing cranking.
Today's
up.
One of those days. I mean, to have this conversation, obviously, you know, you talk about the nostalgia, but there's probably a lot of people who are listening right now who just don't have central air. You know, and that could possibly be, you know, the old buildings here in Chicago. They just weren't outfitted even in some of the suburbs. So, you know, it's not a choice. I act like it's a choice. Like, oh, if I could go back to the days, the romantic days of the heats and the box fan. Not so romantic.
I understand.
You know what I mean? Like, I just kind of think it back on what I just said. Oh, a beer in my hand, writing poetry on the ledge. I wish it was a simpler time. That's not true.
I remember 3 months straight of not sleeping.
Exactly. There's nothing worse. There's nothing worse than this kind of heat, the heat that was on today, like at 3 or 4 o'clock, and then trying to go to bed with it. It's the worst.
Because you're out and you're hot and you come home and you just are hot again, more hot. And you just sit there and you're a pool of sweat.
Yeah, that's no good.
Just wishing for October.
The best is taking a shower, hopping out of the shower when it's this humid. Why even bother?
Why even bother?
Really?
This might be when you go cold. There's always there's like one moment in your life where you're like, I'm going with a cold shower. It's going to feel good for a second. And that's it. That and hangovers. I'll do that in a hangover where I'll go cold real quick right before I shut it off. I go cold and it hits you for a second, then you shut it off. You're like, I'm up.
I could do this.
It doesn't work.
Oh.
But it tricks your brain for like 20 seconds to think like it does. For like maybe 5 minutes, you're like, oh, man, all right, give me another drink. I'm ready to go. But it doesn't really work. So, yeah, but to tell you, I have to have the central air. At this point in my life, I feel like I have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be a mistake not to. But
well, yeah.
When I was, it's funny, transition to the band that's coming up, Twin Peaks. Mike James, who's the owner of the Heartland, who was on at the big table about a month ago, his son Caden is in Twin Peaks. And it reminds me of the air conditioning issue when we had theater, live theater. We do in the black box behind the Heartland, there's this Heartland studio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we did the Schadenfreude shows when we first started, and that's where we got great reviews real quick. And so there were lines around the corner to come into this 35-seat black box theater. And that was awesome in the winter, right? When we got to summer, realized there was no AC in the thing. And so the lines were still coming around, and you would go in there and you turn those floodlights on for a stage, and you would see, I mean, the sweat, especially for the performers, I'd lose pounds after pounds. But for the audience, it was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, yeah. So we had to, like, we talked to Mike about getting an AC unit, and he's like, okay, go ahead and go down to Home Depot and get one. So we got one. We got it in there. And then what we'd have to do is we tricked it out. It didn't really work. Like, it would keep it cool, like, you'd be like, oh, this is nice to walk into. But then you're talking about a theater show where people move and bright, mm-hmm. you know, lights, it's hot. Like it just evaporated and it was hot. So we would stay out of the theater until the show started. Like we'd keep the lights off and everything and turn them on mm-hmm. right when the show started mm-hmm. just to try to, at the last possible moment, keep it cool in there. And so we would do all of our rehearsing and stuff out in the alleyway. So people walk by like, what are these guys doing going over lines and stuff? We're like, well, we can't go in because it's trying to keep it cool. It was like, that's theater. That's when you know that you only have a finite amount of AC and you got to keep it. That's, you know, that's how we would do it. And then what we would do is we would go, it was a $3 show when it started. We had a huge meeting, Pete. You would love this. We had a huge meeting, like, throw down meeting to move it to $5. Like it was like, I think we did a hidden ballot. There were seven guys or something. And it was like 4-3 win for $5. But what we do is we'd hand out a cold beer.
Oh, you get that? Yeah. What the price of
it? So it's $3 and a free beer. And we were arguing to move it to $5 and a free beer. That's theater. And you got free AC that we would not be in the space until.
Do you remember the band Fugazi?
Yeah, of course.
They were
love those guys.
They were one of those bands. They were, you know, staunchly independent. They would never charge over $5 for their CDs,
right.
$8 for a concert. When they became pretty big and they were drawing big crowds, and Todd Berry, a comedian that we had on, used to do a really funny bit about Fugazi, and it was like, you know, what do you say we have a meeting? And we, you know, instead of $5, we charge $10, and I can get out of my parents' basement.
There was, I mean, that's it, man. There's something about it. As Mark Gary was talking about last week, but something and over-deliver. Well, if you keep manage expectations and over-deliver, if the show's $3 and a free beer, you've managed expectations, have you not? And then you put on a good show, and they're like, this is the greatest show ever. Because it was $3. Now, if it's $15, they're like, it's somewhat recommended. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Patty Vasquez takes over. Well, it's Pitchfork Week here on the download. The Mega Music Festival hits Union Park this weekend. We're going to bring you some live performances and interviews with some of the acts coming through town. That includes some of the local artists, like the rock band Twin Peaks. That's the track Walk to the One You Love off the album Down in Heaven. The band Twin Peaks is on a roll right now, touring around the country. They just performed on Conan, and they're going to be playing on Friday at the 5:30 time slot at the Pitchfork Music Festival. The band is Caden Lake James, Clay Frankel, Jack Dolan, Colin Kroom, and Connor Brodner. And Caden and Colin are in studio with me tonight.
What's up, dog?
How's it going, my man?
Good to see you guys. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's our pleasure, baby.
Well, I mean, you guys are our Chicago favorite. You guys are having a lot of success.
Too kind.
Too kind. Talk about that. I mean, what's it mean to be Chicago's Twin Peaks?
I mean, you know, we came out of this city playing to no one, playing when we were... I started playing shows here with some of the guys when we were 15, and there was really no ambition or vision of it growing that much back then. So to be able to... we're playing Pitchfork for the second time this year, Lollapalooza last year, big shows in the city, and it's grown outside of the city. It's pretty humbling because we're still just some neighborhood dudes, you know. So, yeah, it's great, man. We love our city, and it feels really good to get the love thrown back at
us. Well, I mean, let's take us back to 15 years old. I mean, you're CPS Products. You guys were hanging out together. What brought you together to play music?
I guess the simple love of playing music is the start with so many people, but I guess we were lucky that we were, you know, seeing a lot of other young cats who were playing shows, you know, before us. The Smith Westerns were doing it, and they were kids our age that were playing, or a little older than us, but they started at our age playing shows, and getting to see this like thriving underground rock scene in Chicago that not a lot of people know about.
Right.
There's like all these house shows and kind of do-it-yourself events where it's, you know, people said, oh, we're not getting booked at clubs, or the promoters aren't promoting well, or it's 21 up all the time, and people are finding other outlets to play music and share their art, and at the end of the day, party with their friends.
Yeah, I mean, that is a big deal in the city of Chicago, especially for musicians who might not be 21 years old. I mean, obviously, that's a lot of musicians who are coming up in the rock scene. Talk about the house show or the house show scene here in Chicago.
I mean, it's definitely, it comes in waves. You know, as it being a DIY community, you know, from time to time, you know, I mean, every house, like DIY venue, will shut down at some point. It's, you know, it's very temporary.
It is illegal.
Yeah, it's illegal. It's unlicensed. I mean,
do you see it in other towns? I mean, you guys play all over the place. You see the same kind of scenes?
Yeah. In the States, it's around for sure. Like about a year and a half ago, we went to Europe and we did 5 house, like DIY shows in the UK. And it was awesome, the response that we'd get. I mean, we just reached out and tried to make something happen in each city, but, no, we got a lot of feedback, like, you know, this just doesn't generally happen, like, over there.
We're lucky with the space we have in the States, too. Like, out there in Europe, you talk to people in France about it, they'll say, you guys do house shows in America, what's up with that? And when it comes down to it, you kind of notice that, like, where would a lot of these people even throw shows? There's not a lot of houses out there. Everybody lives in flats. It's all very...
Right.
Packed tight.
Right.
This is great. Speaking of Chicago musicians, we got the guys from Whitney doing jumping jacks outside the window. I guess
they're coming up.
They're playing later today. So there's a lot of Chicago love going around right now. Love you, boys.
I mean, for a lot of people who might be listening right now and not familiar with a house show, I mean, how does it come together? I mean, not to give away the secrets of the illegal trade, but
well, you know, someone's got an apartment or a house that they rent that you know, apparently they've tried it once at least and it worked, so they figure they keep trying to get away with doing a show in their basement or, you know, on the first floor.
Right.
Have good neighbors. They talk to some of them, tell their neighbors, and they have cool neighbors, and some of them just wing it and go for it. But you know, it's really just people who want to promote art and they want to have a safe scene for people to play, and bands that aren't getting shows that they believe in or their friends' bands, and just a community and a scene coming together and saying, hey, why are we going to have this guy take our money to have us play there?
That's a big part of it.
And make our friends pay $15 to come see us when we could just have a show in the basement and all hang out, because we're here for the art, not to, you know.
Yeah, and this is a big aesthetic when it comes to the punk rock scene here in Chicago, and it has been for years. People playing in garages, people playing in basements. I mean, there's, you know, above storefronts. We had Matt Skiba on from Alkaline True talked about, you know, playing in Elgin.
They used to live at Albion House, which I think is still going strong up in Rogers Park. I think Alkaline Trio used to live back there, like there back in the day.
But that's what I mean. There's a history to this being done in the city of Chicago and the suburbs.
Yeah, I think it works well in Chicago being a spread out city too. Like there's a scene for it in New York, but you know it's probably a little more difficult there sometimes. It's more like lost spaces. It's a different environment in different cities depending on your architecture. But I think where there's a will, there's a way, and pretty much all over the country, people. Especially with social media, the more people learn about other scenes doing it, it's something that thrives for people that don't have another outlet to play and share their art.
Have you guys been in a position where, as you got bigger, as Twin Peaks became much more of a household name and you had more backing of the music industry, where you found yourself moving more towards gigs that you didn't necessarily, I don't want to say want to play, but took away that sort of DIY aesthetic where they're like, well, okay, we're putting you at this club and this club and your fans are going to have to pay the $15.
I think we were comfortable with the fact that at a certain point we had just outgrown house shows. There was too many people who, you know, were so grateful. It's a blessing mm-hmm. that so many people wanted to come to our shows and come see us.
A lot of those people wouldn't want to book us now because if, you know, the word got out that we were playing, the cops would probably show up, and then there goes their DIY venue,
There was definitely a point where there was a couple, it was all kind of at the same moment where it started being, we'd go to play a show and there was just too many people there and the cops were always coming and it was like...
It's like too much of a burden.
It just became a little apparent.
Twin Peaks is a burden.
I love playing shows like that because they are so intimate and personal and there's no stage between you. It's just you and the people right there and you're all sharing that experience together. There's no green room backstage or anything. You're just hanging out.
Oh yeah.
And when opportunities come up to do that, which unfortunately is not often in Chicago for us, but of all cities, but you know, it's still something great. And
well, that's why
we go out to a lot of shows like that to see friends still, you know, it's still very much the community that we love to be a part of.
Yeah, that's why we didn't have you guys perform tonight, because we were afraid the cops are going to show up on Michigan Avenue. Yeah. This is our house.
They'll show up on Michigan Avenue.
In studio with me, Caden Lake James and Colin Kroom. We'll take a quick break. Okay. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Twin Peaks playing Pitchfork Music Festival this Friday night. Stay with us. It's a download. That's Twin Peaks. The guys from Twin Peaks are in studio with us. They're playing Pitchfork Music Festival this Friday night, 5:30. The album Down in Heaven is the new one. They're on tour right now. I mean, you guys have toured all over the place. Every time I look at your Instagram or whatever, you guys are out on the road. How often are you out performing on tour?
Colin, how many shows did we do last year? He had this calculated at some point.
Yeah, at one point when I got home from tour last year, I decided to count. It was somewhere around like 115, 120.
Wow.
And so we're like looking at about 3 days it would be or something.
Yeah. And it's looking like it's gonna be it's the same for this year.
Yeah, maybe a little more. Which is great, I mean, obviously
you have to do it. I mean, that's part of the life.
A lot of bands can't hang on tour. They just it's a drag for a lot of bands, and you know, it is a very physically and mentally exhausting ordeal, but we're really lucky that it's, you know, just a bunch of, for whatever it is, we all get along and we're all like, we're just warriors with it and know that it's, you got to do it, so we make it work. And we got a good team. So
how do you guys, I mean, when you get to a certain level where you guys are at, where you're playing shows like Lollapalooza and Pitchfork, does the touring change? I mean, do you guys stick pretty much like get in a van and that's what we do?
It's pretty much the same. I mean, you know, we did this last tour with the band Cage the Elephant, Portugal the Man, and you know, being a part of such a production was something we were unfamiliar with. You know, we pulled up in our little van when we got to Louisville, and we were like, "All right, just park next to the four tour buses," you know, and like
four
the four semis, and
right,
all that stuff, you know. And that's
it's a different style of tour when you're at that level. Which Cage the Elephant, they don't get off that bus. I talked to the guitar player one time. He's like, "Yeah, I've been to Chicago, but really, I just stayed in the tour bus till it was time for sound check at the Aragon.
Like, yeah, yeah, like, yeah, exactly. So
Brad, I mean, does stay on the bus. That's Brad, not a lie.
Yeah, he does like that bus. He likes that bus a lot. but yeah, no, I mean, I still love being in a van, you know? Like, I mean, we have a Ford Econoline that would treats us like gold, so, you know, why take it anywhere else?
There you go. Talking with the guys from Twin Peaks here on the download. So talk about, I mean, recording music. Talk about the, you know, for you, Down in Heaven is out, and you guys have put out three albums now. Talk about the evolution of the music. I mean, you guys have started where, you know, you were straight ahead rock and roll. As you get more and more opportunity to expand your audience, does your music change?
Well, I sounded like a little boy when we started, so that's changed a little bit. Because, you know, we put out our first record, we recorded it when we were all 18. So we certainly, very integral years in your life going through. Basically, we would have graduated college this year if we had been in college and not on the road the whole time. But we've just, like, we've gotten much, or, you know, I think our musicianship has definitely improved being on the road for 4 years playing every night. That's the best way to get better, playing with people every night of the week, almost.
Do you see that? Do you feel that going into the new recordings and when you go into Down in Heaven? Do you feel that, like, your musicianship has changed?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I mean, I play keys mainly in Twin Peaks, and, you know, I never took a lesson there. Like, I never thought I'd play keys in a band. I never thought, but, like, you know, just playing the same thing every night, you know, your chops grow inevitably, and also just being on tour and, like, seeing so much music, that also has such an important factor.
Seeing incredible bands, playing with incredible bands, you know, you have hours every day now that we have Spotify to be listening to all sorts of music on the road, in the van, and just expanding your palate all the time. And we're grateful for, you know, it's like very close with these Whitney boys, and these guys are always sending me music I got to check out, and what they're getting turned on to informs us, and it's all very, you know, it all rubs off, I guess.
Well, Whitney's going to be in for Studio 435 at 10 o'clock, and talk about Whitney, you guys, Whitney, other bands, you know, that are having success here in the Chicago indie rock scene. You know, talk about that scene. How has it evolved? I mean, we talked right at the beginning about house shows, but as you guys mature and you graduate to playing metros and bigger shows here in Chicago when you're in town, what's the scene like that's around you guys?
I mean, it's still a bunch of friends that, you know, respect each other musically and, you know, either work at the same restaurants or bars or whatever, and just like to play shows, like to be around each other and play music and drink beer and have fun.
I mean, yeah, nowadays I go and see bands at bars a fair amount, which is certainly different for me.
Yeah, right. I mean,
yeah, I just saw a band that's really great in Chicago, The Hex. They were playing at the Owl. You know, it's all sorts of different stuff.
Knee High, that's a band we went on tour with this last leg.
Yeah, they were in here.
Label mates and close friends of ours. Yeah, mm-hmm. And they still do. They run the gamut. They're on that transition period themselves. I feel like where they're starting to play clubs all over. Wow, these Whitney boys won't leave us alone, man.
they're bothering you guys in the Michigan Avenue window.
Distracting me, man.
I love it.
it's great that it's a close-knit community, though, because I feel like in Chicago, we've never had a lot of industry in Chicago. Like, there's been a couple labels.
There's been industry based here, but it hasn't necessarily focused on Chicago. It generally was looking at New York or L.A., and now I feel like together, the Chicago music scene, especially in rock and roll, is, like, coming back. And it feels good.
Well, and it's like, you know, I guess what I was going to get at, too, is if you're a lot of bands, like, either come up or go to L.A. or New York or Nashville or, like, a city like that because there's a lot of industry based there and they feel there's opportunity there to get picked up on, you know, you're going to play a show and there's going to be someone who works for this label or this manager is going to be there and you're going to get a break. And it gives a kind of competitive air to playing shows and meeting other bands. I think that's, you know, totally not 100% of the reality, but there's an air of that for a lot of bands, I'm sure. You know, I'm sure that there's a million bands that just want to play good shows with their friends, and that's the only thing that drives them. But in Chicago, with the lack of all that industry, I think that's really a prevalent thing here, that it's a very community-oriented scene where people are really trying to gain things off of each other, and you know, maybe that'll change with more and more, you know, in the hip hop community. Chicago is totally like a beacon right now. It's becoming a mecca again.
But that wasn't always the case. I mean, obviously what we're seeing with the draw, the industry is coming here looking for talent. Do you feel the same way with the rock scene, with the indie rock scene, where Chicago's developing, I guess, their own unique voice? Not unlike what we saw here in Chicago in the 90s, where, you know, it was Urge Overkills and the Smashing Pumpkins and those kind of bands that just kind of drew all of the industry here, and they just, whoever was from Chicago got signed. Do you see in this new world order, where there isn't really a record company or record industry, the same kind of thing happening for rock and roll in Chicago?
Well, I think that there's always been powerful scenes here, and you know, there was like a lot of the touch and go bands in the 80s, where there was a lot of Chicago bands that were, there's a really integral punk scene out here with Naked Reagan and all that, and you know, Wilco coming out of Chicago. There's always been a powerful scene here. And just a lot of the time it was overlooked by the happenstance of where it falls in the country and what was out here. But with social media now and just the kind of infinite ways that we can all connect and communicate with each other, I think more and more people are picking up on artists from Chicago.
Are you noticing it on tour, when you guys go on tour, that they say,
yeah. Just Chicago, also, it's like Twin how Peaks. Many friends like right. I'm with in bands that feel like they're doing successful and like whatever of the world looking at it, but people feeling like they're finding success or feel comfortable saying, I'm going to lose my job to be on the road and do this because, you know, it feels like they're doing it. It feels like there's a scene happening here. So, you know, not going to predict anything, but it's like, I do think that there's an air in Chicago with a lot of bands that it feels like it's a good scene to come from right now. And it's a lot of people encouraging each other to just go for it, because there's a good track record of bands now from out here where it's like, you know, you go for it and you got a good shot at doing this.
Right.
And I think people are starting to like tune in to Chicago now too, which is nice. You know, there's nothing cooler than like going on tour and seeing like your friend's band's t-shirt on someone in like Tulsa or like, you know, Las Vegas or something like that.
And I do want to like just touch on like, of course it is a different scene and there's things that separate it. The Chicago hip-hop scene and rock scene, but they're a lot more closely aligned than you would think. And like a lot of people who are coming up in the Chicago rap scene were people we were hanging out with in high school,
right.
And they, you know, Chance the Rapper is watching Whitney's set, Joey Purple comes out to Twin Peaks house shows, you know, and we're going to their shows. It's always been like, it's obviously a different scene, but they inform each other. And as I was saying, it's all that community. Everybody wants to see each other succeed. Everybody's promoting each other's stuff. It's
Well, your generation of musicians, I mean, I think of you guys, and like you just mentioned, the Save Money crew and the crew from Chicago that came out of Chicago Public Schools and lived here in Chicago proper for the last 5 years, is something that's really interesting. And as people who like the music scene in Chicago and like music in general, there's something about Twin Peaks, Whitney, the bands that we're seeing, like you just mentioned, Chance the Rapper, that are turning heads at a national level, and it's pretty impressive.
A lot of us are really fortunate, too, that we came out of, you know, and this is a big issue with things happening in the city now that's at jeopardy, but we all came out of a very lucky Chicago public school system. And a lot of us, you know, guys in Smith Westerns, who some of them are in Whitney now, Chance, Joey, all of us were going to the selective enrollment schools in the city, and you know, there's just a lot of opportunity and encouragement there to be, you know, working on art and, you know, just kind of being compassionate and passionate about what you do. And I think that, you know, I can't say exactly what it is, but I think there's a connection there, and it's like, it's something you can't help but connect the dots there, where a lot of the bands that are doing really successful came out of that community of schools.
Yeah, Jones, Lane Tech,
Whitney Young, yeah. Northside, yeah.
It's interesting.
And so I'm grateful for that, and that's, you know, with Rahm closing a lot of schools in the city and stuff like that happening, it's something to be aware of, that, you know, it's obviously provides so much opportunity for kids. They just closed Gallery 37, you know, some of the guys in Whitney were in the jazz band there, Will was, I played in jazz band down there, so many visual artists. It's like, There's
yeah, Donnie Trumpet was talking about that. He was just on the show last week.
Totally.
He did Gallery 37, yeah.
And all the guys from Kids These Days, yeah, it's you know, we were all provided with a lot of encouragement and opportunity from all that, and it's a little it's sad and a little scary to see those things being taken away, and we'll see how that affects the next. It'll probably only fuel the fire, though, for kids that, you know,
yeah, they're
looking for
an
outlet.
Out.
It's
right.
Like, well, you can take that away. Look what I can do. That's what I can hope. And hopefully we talk about these things enough and show how important it is. We can get more opportunities going for kids.
Caden Lake James and Colin Kroom in studio. They are members of the band Twin Peaks. They're playing at Pitchfork Friday night, 5:30. Their album's Down in Heaven. We'll take a break for the news. We'll come back, talk some more. So stay with us. Twin Peaks in studio with me, Caden Lake James and Colin Kroom. It's the download here on 720 WGN. Twin Peaks is playing at Pitchfork Music Festival coming up.
Hey,
you guys like playing outside?
I sometimes prefer to play inside, but yeah. I can have a great time outside.
No, it's probably a good time, but is it hard to control?
This sound is a little more difficult, but it's gotten very fun for us, and it's definitely improved for us playing festivals and playing to festival crowds. It's a different thing, and it's a lot of fun.
You've adapted to it?
Totally. I dig it. We've had to do it a lot in the last year, so it's like you might as well enjoy it. And it's cool how many people get to come out and see it one time. And if it's an enthusiastic festival crowd, that's so awesome because it's huge. But, you know, I got it down in a venue. It's an intimate crowd. It's, you know. I got that.
What do you got down?
Well, you can. I mean, you're creating more of a.
I got down making riotous crap go down. I had to watch my language. I don't know. I can control the chaos a little bit more.
Yeah, you get.
And you're closer. It's just festivals. You always have the barrier between you.
Yeah.
You know, it's you know, it's just a different thing. I'm not trying to knock it because I do love it too.
No, of course.
I love it.
But I mean,
it
is. It definitely is something different. I mean, but yeah. I'm interested in how you guys prepare for your performances. I mean, obviously, you know, you got the big show coming up at Pitchfork, but let's say you're playing a Metro sold out Saturday night. I mean, is it just like party until you get on stage, or is there a ritual that goes into a Twin Peaks show?
Kind of. I mean,. You know, you want to loosen up and have a couple beers before you play.
Certainly,
you know?
Nothing religious. There's no like thing that we do every time beforehand. We don't get the huddle going. If that might happen once in a blue moon if someone starts it, but usually it's just kind of like you get ready and you guys got to go on and
the band, the primary players in the band, you've been together for so long. I mean, has it become sort of second nature? Do you guys, I guess what I'm getting at is like, how strict are you with the set list, with the ritual beforehand? I mean, do you guys pretty much just play off each other?
It's, you know, a lot of the songs are very second nature at this point, and it's so great having a new record out so that we can switch up the set list a bit. A lot of the times we are the kind of band that's like, you get a set list that works and you're just like, we know it, don't write a new one. But, you know, we try to switch it up between legs of tours so you're not coming to the same show twice in the same city or anything.
Right,
But, yeah. Yeah, we got set lists that work. Yeah. We know what songs sound good together. You got little groups, you move them around. Yeah. It's like a little Tetris.
It's nice, too. I mean, we have, like, four songwriters and whoever writes the song sings the song, so you know we get to kind of play around and like keep it interesting, not have like one person sing like, you know, six songs in a row and like,
right,
yeah, there's variety. It's nice.
And I mean, we definitely take our musicianship seriously and we want to nail our stuff and have a great show, but I certainly would say if you see us on stage, I wouldn't say we're strict with our performance. Strict is far from the right word.
Let's take it before you get on stage. Let's talk about the development of the music. I mean, how are you guys What's your process when it comes to making music? Are you the kind of band that bring in a song, you demo it, you all work it out together? Are you the band that goes out to the farmhouse in Michigan? What's the process behind the music for Twin Peaks?
Well, you know, we got four songwriters, so everybody, it's, you know, certainly has a little bit of their own thing. But for the most part, it's like we write the most when we're at home, when we got time off of tour to decompress, and kind of band where someone really kind of demos a song, writes it, then brings it to the band. Sometimes got all the parts written out, sometimes it's more than half, you know. And then we if everybody's feeling it, we try it out. Usually most parts stick around, but especially on the new album, there was a lot more people were improvising a little more, and that's what I was saying about I feel like we've grown a lot as musicians, because in the past albums it was a little more like, all right, you wrote these parts, we'll play those parts. In this new record, we were actually out at like a farmhouse almost in Massachusetts recording this great estate with a lake on the property, really like waking up at 3, going on the canoe before even thinking about recording, you know, getting out in that vibe and then saying, okay, what song do you want to do? Let me play around with the parts for a while and kind of flexing a little more and everybody putting their own vibe on their instrument into a little more, which
We've had a couple of musicians in here just recently. Lydia Lovelace was on right before the Square Roots Festival, and she talked about how, you know, when she did put out one of her records, she threw out all the songs before she start, like she threw them out. She did them and she's like, I'm going in a different direction. I mean, what's the process like in terms of, you have four songwriters, so I would assume that that there's a lot of material that you guys are putting together to put a record together.
There's a lot of backlog. There's a lot of songs that, you know, maybe we'll get to one day, maybe we won't. You know, we all share our songs, and it's kind of like when the time comes to make a record, it's kind of where the band's at, what we've been up to, and it's like, all right, that's going to inform the tone and the vibe of this record. And, you know, this record had a little more laid-back thing going, and I think a lot of it was just straight up, we were listening to a lot of country music in the van, and it was just kind of, we were chilling out a little bit more. Not by any means a country record, but it's got the laid-back vibe a little more than our last two. So it's kind of, you know, I think we've always been a band that's just about winging it, and, you know, not as I said, not being too strict with how we approach it and saying, you know, this, we got to do this for this record. It's kind of like...
Yeah.
We just go off of our feelings, and it's pretty, as I said, I'm really grateful and feel lucky that our band is, you know, it's a struggle for a lot of bands to get a lot of heads together, especially when we have so many songwriters and it is a democratic thing, but we've been really lucky, aligned.
You could throw it to luck, but what do you think it is? I mean, for you guys...
You know, we didn't all grow up together, so I'm not going to say it was just that, but like, I have known Jack almost my whole life, and separately, he's known Connor almost his whole life. Clay comes from a similar background as all of us, and we started hanging out in still formative years when we were like 14 or 15, so known him for so long by this point. This guy was playing music, and that was really a lucky one because this guy, you know, we've said it's so hard to find when you have a unit that was on the road already for a while before Colin was playing with us, to find someone that's so in tune with the same kind of music we listen to and approaching it in the same style. And really just entirely adds to it. That's a difficult thing, and that was something I'll say was maybe not luck, but destiny. But, you know, it can be tough, man. It can be tough for a lot of bands, and I have so many friends that have trouble putting together a band who are great artists who could do so much, but it's just like... It can be hard, and we did... One of the things is like we it applied ourselves and tried to start doing it when we were in high school. And we said, you know, we knew bands like the Funds and White Mystery that coming out of Chicago that would book their own tours. And, you know, kind of like I read Get in the Van back in the day and Henry Rollins' tour book about Black Flag. And they were booking all their own stuff still back in the day. And, it's like when we were in our senior year of high school, we just kind of like booked a tour for the summer, just kind of like, you know, we're all going to go to college, but let's do a tour. Let's see the country. Let's play these shows because we can do it and it'll be fun. And, you know, and we realized a week before we don't have anything to sell. We don't have a record or anything, like a CD or a shirt or anything. So let's record the set in the basement, and that turned into our first record. And it was, you know, I think we all kind of realized, even if we denied it for a while because the reality of going to school, but we all kind of realized that
wow, this is awesome. We love it, and people seem to enjoy it.
Is that a
even
tough
just playing basements all over the country?
Is that a tough decision at the time for you guys? I mean, there's a lot of expectations to say, hey, you know, from parents, from society, be like, go to what do you mean you're going to go on tour and play basements?
There was all sorts of there was all sorts of reactions to it, and some of us it was like, yo, this is a no brainer. And you know, it wasn't till we had a very loose guarantee of anything, but a label, Autumn Tone Records out of L.A., said they would re-release that record we had recorded for that first tour on vinyl and give us one show at South By, and that was kind of like all that we had to run off of. But it was like, whoa, we can get to South By, and we're going to have a vinyl of the record? Of course, we have to drop out of school, you know, which for some people that's crazy. For us, it was like, we have to do it, and some people were like, dude, I paid to come here to college, like, that's, my parents are not going to like that. But at the end of the day, when it was just kind of like, we're all talking about it a lot, and it's like, dude, like, we can go back if it doesn't work, but wasn't this fun? Let's do it.
Well, here you guys are. I mean, and with Down in Heaven and the success that Twin Peaks has had, I mean, you guys are on Conan. I didn't even ask about that experience, about being on late night talk shows now. But, I mean, when you think about, you know, that, the idea of, I mean, are you at a stage where you're confident in your decisions to be musicians full time, or do you still have to think about your rent and think about going to, you know, working a bar or whatever it is?
I have no misconception that I'm going to be loaded from doing this and that I'll be able to take care of a family one day from doing it. But I also wouldn't be surprised if I'm playing bars when I'm 40 because I love playing music. And at this point, I still got time to turn around if I decide to. I'm 22, but, you know, it seems like the trajectory is going.
It's over.
You play music, and whether it's, you know, working at a club or giving lessons, I think that I'll always somehow, you know, find a way to have my life revolve around music in one sense or another.
I reckon if you're playing clubs when you're 40, I'll probably be bartending that club you're playing at. but, yeah, no, I mean, this is... You know, at some point you kind of realize, like, this is kind of, you know, you're lucky to figure out what, you know, you're meant to do here, you know. I don't know, people figure out what they want to do with their lives when they're 50. And you think about, you know, how much time and wasted and stuff like that. You know, we're really fortunate to have gotten the opportunity to figure out what the heck we're here for.
Man, so, I've been to Australia and Europe and in Mexico and Canada, and I'm 22. I got a lot of places left to go, and I got the taste for it. And once you get the taste, it's like, let me hit it. I want to go to Japan. I see bands like Heinz playing Singapore and Vietnam. It's like, how'd your booking agent get you that show? Because I want to go do that, you know? Like, I want to play Russia. I want to play Africa. I want to play the Middle East. You know, I want to play South America so bad. South America seems like they really get down with rock and roll.
Oh, yeah.
I got to get down there. I got to play some shows down there. So, you know, that's,
you heard it,
that drive's not going to go away. It's like, who knows if I'll get to half or any of those places past where we've been now, but, I don't see why I wouldn't try, you know?
Well, you heard it here first. I mean, we will, maybe you guys can come in when you book Vietnam, you know, you come in.
Yeah, we'll give you a phone call.
Yeah, just let us know.
We'll give you the live from Saigon.
It'll be like 8 a.m. there or something.
The band Twin Peaks is playing at Pitchfork this weekend, Friday night, 5:30. Caden Lake James, Colin Kroom in studio with me. Congrats on the success. Congrats on the album Down in Heaven. And continued success with the band.
Appreciate it, brother.
Thank you very much, man.
All right. It's like the closest beat that I get to, like, you know, being on 120 minutes. You know, some rock stars in the studio.
Yeah, how about that?
Great. Twin Peaks at Pitchfork on Friday night. It's unbelievable. You look at their stuff online. And the band Whitney, too, coming up here. I mean, their followings alone, like the people who, you know, just like on their Twitter followings and YouTube clips and things like that, it's in the hundreds of thousands. Pretty impressive for 22-year-olds from Lane Tech High School in Jones.
I know. Been all over the world.
Yeah.
But still have the taste for more.
You could say it. You say it every time.
I'm not going to say it. But I think it was when I was 22, I think I had been to the Dells. I mean, that's about it.
You're so true. It's so true. I think I might have made it to Galena. I'm going to lie to you. There might have been a trip to Madison, like to a college like party. Oh, no, I will say I did take a road trip to Ann Arbor for like a Michigan thing. But I could have been over 22. That's the thing. Like, all I could think about was I was 22 living in Lincoln Square above the Hansa Clipper.
Mm-hmm.
During the heat wave of 95. So I would have been like 20. I don't remember any rock and roll involved in that at all. I remember being like, oh, this box fan. Oh, drinking my tall boy. And I got illegally from somewhere. No, but I think there's some really interesting things that came out of that. And I can't wait to talk to Whitney about the same stuff. I mean, obviously putting together a scene around rock and roll is pretty impressive to have it kind of bubble up out of that house scene. And we never think about that, but that's been something that for artistic purposes, especially entertainment,
mm-hmm.
it's been around forever. I mean, we could talk to Naked Raygun about that and they could tell us, oh, we did house parties in the early 80s. You could talk to comedians who will tell you the same thing,
yeah.
but it's good to know it's alive and well, that there is a scene in Chicago. Now, you know, it's probably not that safe at the end of the day in terms of, you know, being able to bounce. That's why they say it's illegal, because, you know, you're packing 250 kids into a basement while the parents are in the Dells. That might be trouble, you know? I don't know. But I do like the Chicago Public School stuff too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, for as much as we in the newspapers and you hear it nonstop, and it's kind of awful, the rhetoric, the negative kind of connotation to Chicago public schools.
Right.
Oh, well, they don't make enough money. They don't. The money's off. There's no funding. Everyone leaves the suburbs, and then there's this bubbling counterculture that is not that's not the storyline. The storyline is you're getting a lot of artists, musicians, entertainers, comedians that are coming out of Chicago public schools at the age 20, 21, 22 that are making us, you know, mad.
You're right, though. I mean, yeah. If the you know, you hear about, you know, the economic woes, and if these programs get canceled, you know, most people don't think anything of it, but it's like,
yeah.
When you see these young kids doing all sorts of amazing things.
If you could make a direct correlation that Gallery 37 is the place where a lot of city kids are going to hone to find interest and passion, and mm-hmm. then when they get older, they become of age, they're the ones that we're listening to on Spotify, or they're the ones that, you know, we're watching on TV, and it's entertainment. So it's like, there's an investor, societal investment, not just of like, you know, we always kind of couch that program as sort of like, well, kids keeps kids safe and off the streets. No, it inspires kids to maybe take a path down towards their passion.
Yep.
Where maybe they weren't given that opportunity before. So it is something that I think is you could make a strong argument needs to be part of the city of Chicago, and philanthropy should step up and fund that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if they're not going to do it, Pete and I will do it. How much are we talking about? It's a lot of money. We'll do a lemonade bake sale kind of thing. Coming up, the band Whitney.
Yeah.
They're going to be live here at Studio 435. All 70 here tonight? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, Bob's working it. There are microphones everywhere. We have deconstructed the showcase studio here, the Allstate Showcase Studio for Studio 435, which is what the segment's intended. You know, this is the idea of transforming a space here on Michigan Avenue into, and we should, now that we've, you know, started to explore the idea of these DIY house parties, maybe there's something in there. You know, we were talking about naming it Studio 435 and it's stuck, but I think we should like call it like Michigan Avenue House Party or something like that. You know, like the basement, Tribune Tower basement.
The basement? The basement tapes? I think that's taken.
That's taken.
Yeah.
Punks. All right. Well, we'll stick with Studio 435 for now. But I do appreciate, you know, the idea of the work that Bob does to transform the studio. You can hear the voices and the musicians setting up in the background right now. But it's impressive to not only know that they're going to perform live in studio,
mm-hmm.
but they did it by essentially taking a space and transforming it right before our eyes, yeah, and doing it in such short amount of time. It's impressive all the way across the board.
I think next week there's a duo, so I'm going to give Bob a break.
Boring.
So I always feel bad that,
Bob, he loves
he's
it.
He's like sweating.
He loves it. It's his workout. You do Orange Theory.
Yeah, I fell on the treadmill. I fell on the treadmill today.
What are you talking about? So you told me this for a second. You showed me your skinned arm. What are you talking about? What happened?
I was on the treadmill.
Uh-huh. Like everybody
does. And
you turned into a comedy routine?
Yeah.
Like Benny an Amy Hill Schumer or sketch? Something.
Yeah. Benny Hill or Amy Schumer.
One of the two, right. The classics of comedy.
Yeah, I was just, I don't know, like it wasn't at the end of the workout. It was right at the beginning. It was during the warm-up, so I wasn't, like, out of breath or going too hard. I was just, like, I don't know if I was daydreaming, and just my feet got to... Yeah, my feet came out from under me, and I... Boom! Right on the treadmill as it was going, and I just like you see on like, America's Funniest Home Videos. Yeah, I slid down the whole.
What's wrong with you?
And I like scraped up my knee and my arm.
Did the whole gym stop? Did they stop playing like the Avril Lavigne and come over and help you?
the coach, he came over for a second, but then
is he mic'd up? Is the coach
mic'd
up?
Yeah, he's mic'd up.
So I was like, Zimmerman's down.
Wait, the coach for a treadmill?
Yeah, he's in Orange Theory, Rob. This is like some hardcore stuff.
Yeah. Wow. Are you familiar with Orange Theory?
Not at all.
Yeah. It's like a 1 hour high intense workout.
It's workout cult. He's in a workout cult.
It is, yeah. And so he came up, the coach came up, but I was running next to my wife, who
did not help.
She was like, she's got to get her heart rate up.
Immediately disowned you.
Yeah, she pretended she didn't know you. There's no win there for her. She's not going to stop her workout and be like, "Are you okay, doofus?"
And obviously you feel like the biggest tool because you fell on a treadmill. I fell on a treadmill.
How do you fall on a treadmill? Like that's like straight out of like a Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to put you down. That's the name of the movie, but it really is like slapstick, like a Steve Martin move.
Yeah. Yeah, do a pratfall, Dan Aykroyd.
Did anyone cheer? Were they like, great artistry? That's amazing.
I just tried to like, the coach came over and I was trying to kind of like, bust him, I'm fine, but I was hurting.
Did you get up and keep going?
And then because right at the beginning of the class, I had to keep on going, and it was, and then you just feel like the biggest idiot, because you're the person that has...
Has fallen. You can't get up.
You are no longer Pete Zimmerman. You are now Peter Sellers.
Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Tonight it's time for Studio 435, our Monday night segment that features live performances and great up-and-coming bands. Tonight, another band that will be playing Pitchfork this weekend, the Chicago band Whitney. The duo Max Kakasic and Julian Ehrlich formed Whitney after their band, the Smith Westerns, broke up. They just put out the album Light Upon the Lake, just back in June here. The seven-piece band is playing Pitchfork Friday at 4:15 p.m., and they are here in studio tonight. Whitney is Max Kakasic, Julian Ehrlich, Josiah Marshall, Will Miller, Malcolm Brown, Print Chateau, and Charles Glander. Thanks, guys, for being in the studio. Appreciate it. We're going to hear some live
What's
music
up,
here.
Man?
What's
Thank
up?
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks for being here. You said your buddies from Twin Peaks here on the...
We popped out like behind this little window area and kind of like tried to give them like the bunny ears behind their head.
Right. We're going to hear some live music. We'll do it right coming up here after the break. But talk about the band Whitney, how you guys made the transition from Smith Westerns to this band.
We were just, honestly, it had been like 6 months since either of us had like been making music, I think like super seriously. We were like dilly-dallying with different projects and stuff. And just kind of like a cold morning in the winter here. And we spent the morning like inside writing a song on a new tape machine. And from that, the whole project was born.
But we made the first song just like kind of to test out the tape machine. So it was like a really.
It's always how a good band starts, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was like an organic thing, and we were like kind of joking around more so. And then it wasn't until we made like the third song where it was like, oh man, we're making an album that we like can stand behind and like. And we want to tour for a long time.
Well, the music's great. I mean, the album is awesome, Light Upon the Lake. It's really, I've heard it called 60s guitar pop. I don't know what, when I saw that, I actually saw it before I listened to the music, and I was like, I don't understand what that means. But, I mean, the music is very melodic. It's very unique.
Yeah.
Talk about your guys' style and where it comes from.
Max is just like, Max is very good at writing melodically like interesting guitar lines, and I think I just like bring a certain sort of like soul when it comes to writing vocal melodies too, and we figured out a way to like make them complement each other in a way that we just like wanted to listen to the songs over and over again. So that was kind of how we crafted the record. It was like maybe a bit selfish in that way. Like we just like made the songs that we loved and wanted to hear like a million times.
What was it about? I mean, I'm always fascinated about, I mean, you guys went from, you know, the duo, they played in a different band. You guys were able to test out the tape machine, get it going. At what point did you say this is a 7-piece band? This is a band that is much bigger than just the two of us.
I think it must have been probably after we wrote like the fifth song or so. We had done Golden Days and Polly, which are two of like the larger arrangements on the album. And, again, even at that point, it wasn't something that playing live was on our minds at the time. But
it wasn't like the goal, yeah, really.
Like we were just kind of trying to finish this project that we've been like writing wise, you know.
Yeah.
And then in January of last year, we were like, we're gonna start playing shows together. And I think we first tried it with six people. That
yeah.
Was, like, we didn't even try with
oh,
us.
Oh yeah. And it's really cool. This is like maybe veering off to like a different tangent, but like our horn play, like one of the biggest things was like, how are we gonna get an entire horn section into our live show?
Right.
And our horn player like had bought this pedal that is like basically like a vocal harmonizer. So it's like, if you are like a lead singer and you want like a like three harmonies behind you, you'll buy this pedal and you'll set it up to, you know, perform them for you basically. I had never even thought about this, but like our horn player was just like, I'm going to try this out on my horn. And he now plays his entire horn section on a MIDI keyboard.
Wow.
Through this harmonizer to create the effect of like an entire horn section. And it literally sounds amazing. I mean, like, yeah.
I actually remember he like sent us an email of a voice memo of him playing the thing for the first time. It was like, do you guys think this is going to work? And I was like,
it was like, oh my God, like we couldn't tell the difference. So it was like,
where'd you get all those horns? Right.
Yeah. It's pretty remarkable.
Well, I mean, for you guys, I mean, you have a Chicago pedigree. I mean, the band Smith Westerns was a band that played Pitchfork, has done a lot of stuff. I mean, after the breakup, was the goal, like you said, you dilly-dallied for a couple months, but was the goal to find different musicians, to continue being musicians? What was the goal after the end of Smith Westerns?
We didn't, and I think it's like most important that we didn't have a goal. It was really like, we kind of like had to purge some ideas that weren't necessarily going to form into an entire cohesive album or a project or whatever. And then like, that's why it's such a special thing, is that we just like kind of randomly found it one morning when we weren't even looking for it. And then the inspiration was almost immediately there, and then we had to chase it and basically like attack it, what we had found that one morning. So
and also like I think I heard the Twin Peaks guys talking about the Chicago community and whatnot, and we're like lucky enough to have lots of friends who like are with like have places within multiple avenues of art, photography, painting, and whatnot. And I think the people that we were hanging out with at the time were super inspirational, and like kind of everyone was making stuff, and just our voice and making art as music. So we were just kind of like trying to be part of that group and like create stuff as a like Chicago artist.
Yeah, I was gonna say there's a lot that's happening. We talked with the guys from Twin Peaks about how they're in a lot of different genres of music. There's a lot that's bubbling up in your generation of music and performance here in Chicago. Do you feel that? Do you feel that there's a lot more that's happening in this sort of time than maybe previous 5, 10, 15 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just a lot of hungry kids, like whether it be like hip hop or maybe like alternative indie, whatever. Also, shout out to Aaron Steinbrecher because I know he's listening right now. I love you. yeah, I think there's a lot of young people that they want to make their mark, and a lot of people are really doing it right now.
I guess like in a positive way, like
I love it.
When Smith Westerns were first starting, like the tagline was like young kids from Chicago, but now that like in the best way possible, like no one can say that anymore because there's so many young bands coming out from Chicago. That's like. There aren't like all bands are like usually.
You guys are kind of the elder statesmen,
yeah,
right?
I know, right?
How old are you guys?
25.
Yeah, so you're
24.
The,
yeah, 25, yeah,
it's almost over for you guys.
Yeah,
yeah.
Way out.
Yeah, I guess so.
Van Whitney in studio tonight. They're in studio 435. We're gonna hear a live performance with them. Let's take a quick break. What we'll do is we'll sound check in the break and get you guys ready to hear some music. Whitney is, we just heard from Max Kakasic and Julian Ehrlich, but Josiah Marshall, Will Miller, Malcolm Brown, Prince Chateau, and Charles Glanders are here in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Stay with us. It's Studio 435 here on the Download, 720 WGN. In studio with us tonight, the band Whitney. The new album is called Light Upon the Lake. The seven-piece band is playing Pitchfork Music Festival Friday night at 4:15. They're in studio with us tonight. Let me get through the names again. Whitney is Matt Kakasic, Julian Ehrlich, Josiah Marshall, Will Miller, Malcolm Brown, Prince Chateau, and Charles Glanders. And we're in studio. We're going to hear Dave's Song. Is that the name of this track? Dave's Song, Whitney live in Studio 435. Take it, guys. Thank you. Woo! There we go. The band Whitney live in studio here, Studio 435 in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Michigan Avenue. The fans out there, you like that music?
Yeah! I'll come sing.
There you go. There you are, right? All right, live in studio with us, the band Whitney. They are playing at Pitchfork Friday night at 4:15. They're in studio tonight. Matt Kakasic, Julian Ehrlich, Josiah Marshall, Will Miller, Malcolm Brown, Prince Choteau, and Charles Glanders. The new album is called Light Upon the Lake. Why don't I get Julian and Max back up on the microphone so we can talk a little bit more before we hit the news here. Great song. I mean, there's just I think you mentioned it a little bit earlier about the arrangements. Talk about arranging that song. I mean, the concept, obviously, it's, you know, we're kind of stripped down on the drum set.
Mm-hmm.
But talk about what goes into arranging a song like that. Is it pretty much, you know, based off the guitar?
Yeah, the song started with that kind of like weird, it's actually a very simple chord progression. So the challenge with that song was making it sound somewhat unique because the chord progression is pretty like classic or basic in a way. But I think the kind of thing that the best part of the song to me is like when the horn comes in during the solo and the whole band kind of stops for a second. Those two hits.
Yeah. That song also on record has full drums. I just don't have a kick pedal, so I have to use I had to resort to just like auxiliary percussion. Yeah, I would say that song, like, that was the first song that we wrote on the record, and then we kind of developed our entire like identity in terms of arrangement later on, like 4 or 5 songs later, and then mm-hmm. we kind of came back to Dave's song and like gave it the treatment that we had kind of developed over the next 4 songs. You know,
how different, like, I mean, when you guys have worked together in the past and you've worked in different band, how, I mean, how much do you rely on that for your chemistry since you've worked together before in studio and on stage, and how much of it is defining a new voice, a voice that you had not sort of expressed before?
Well, I think like the difference is that Jules and I are working like way closer than we ever did before. Smith Western's the writing team was like a little different. But with Whitney, it's like more of him and I kind of like playing off each other constantly. And I don't know, I think both of us take constructive criticism really well.
Yeah.
And like, there's not really much ego in the band, which is like really easy.
Yeah.
Fun.
We can like, I don't know. It's just like very easy to tell Max or whatever. It's like, if there's something that I want changed or something so I can maybe do my job a little better, and like same thing vice versa with him, it's like it's very easy, and we'll just kind of make way for each other to like make the song the best that it can possibly be
with the arrangements that you have. And you talked about the pedal and being able to sort of, you know, sort of sync up the horn to sound like horns.
Yeah.
Is it difficult for you guys, or maybe a better way to phrase this, is it a challenge for you guys when you go on the road and you're playing at different venues, and maybe some venues are more sophisticated than others in the setup of what you guys are doing? Is it a challenge to sort of get your sound right?
No, but that was also like our first show ever. We like had our sound guy, who we consider like a band member, his name's Charles, and he's the only sound guy that I've ever met in my entire life that was like my age, like honestly.
Really?
Yeah, and we've like done this. I've toured for like 4 years. So yeah, it was like a breath of fresh air, and he did our first show, and it was just kind of like match made in heaven. We like just brought him on, and coming back to your question, yeah. He does that. He makes it so our band actually does come across the way that we want it to in every different venue, in every small, big room, like wherever we're at. Basement. It's
right,
like he does a really good job of that.
That's good. I mean, that's good to have that person with you, right?
Yeah. Yep. And he know. I mean, like I think he likes the record, and that's why he's so good at it, which is cool.
Talking with the band Whitney in studio, where they're going to perform again here after the news. We'll take a break and sound check some more stuff. I mean, for you guys, we talked a lot with Twin Peaks about being from Chicago. Is that part of your identity? I mean, when you guys hit the tour and play different places, does Chicago go with you?
Yeah, definitely. Three of the members, myself, Malcolm, and the horn player Will, all went through CPS. Cadian, I went to the same grade school as Cadian, Bell. He went to high school. Malcolm went to high school with Katie, and yeah, so we've all been. It's weird. Like, I remember those kids when they're 2 years younger than me. I think maybe three actually. Are they 3 years?
The Twin Peaks.
Yeah, they're three. Yeah, that's 4 years younger than me. Really? Because I remember Jack Dolan in grade school too. Like all those kids, you know, they were like when I was in eighth grade, they were in like fourth or fifth grade, and now seeing them all playing out. But yeah, I think that, you know, that kind of Chicago mentality like crosses all genre specific borders of music. You know, I know Chance is like, everyone talks about Chance. He's kind of a hero of the city at the moment, but he went to CPS too. He went to Whitney Young, I think, or something like that.
Jones.
Yeah. Why did I think Whitney Young? Dang.
Well, anyways, there's a bond. There's definitely a bond between like all Chicago musicians and having gone through that same system, I think.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I mean, we talked a lot with Twin Peaks about the scene. I mean, you guys are obviously what they were talking about, the bands being tight and being friends. I mean, where do you think that comes from, that communal spirit? I mean, he talked a lot about the house parties and sort of everyone knowing everyone from places outside of the club because you guys kind of came up. But you guys are a little bit older than those guys, but is that similar to you guys?
No, but that same mentality, the thing that's cool is, like, I'm not even from Chicago, but, like, that same sort of like lovable mentality and like community like stretched to me like the moment I got here. So it's like, it really is more than just like being born in Chicago. It's like, I think everyone just wants Chicago to be put on the map at the moment. And anyone who shows that they can maybe do that is supported. And it's like, that's the best. Like,
yeah, right.
I love it, man.
Julian Ehrlich and Max Kakasic are in studio with me from the band Whitney. The band will play some more music here after the news. They're playing Pitchfork on Friday night, 4:15. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get the news, and then we'll get some more music. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Studio 435 right now in the Allstate Showcase Studio. The band Whitney, Chicago band Whitney, which are playing Pitchfork Friday night, 4:15. They're in studio. Their new album, Light Upon the Lake. Whitney is Max Kakasic, Julian Ehrlich, Josiah Marshall, Will Miller, Malcolm Brown, Prince Chouteau, and Charles Glanders. And they're here ready to perform their song, Golden Days. Take it away, guys.
You save me from hanging on. I tell myself what we had is gone. And after all that I put you through, I get knocked out like I never knew. It kept me real till I'm Thank you.
get the street level up for that one. There we go. Clap it up. There we go. It's always a crapshoot when you go to the street mic, guys. The band Whitney in studio here, Studio 435. They are playing at Pitchfork coming up here on Friday night at 4:15. Whitney is Max Kakasic, Julian Ehrlich, Josiah Marshall, Will Milliam, Malcolm Brown, Prince Choteau, and Charles Glanders. Their album is called Light Upon the Lake. They're going to play one more song for us coming up here after the break, but if you guys want to jump back on the mics real quick, we will continue the conversation to the break, and then we'll get one more song from you guys before we let you go. I'm interested, you know, we talked a little bit about that Chicago stuff, and you know, I had a chance to talk with the band before, Twin Peaks, about their process. I mean, you guys have talked about, you know, creating this music by testing out a tape machine. After you start with the writing of the songs and the demos and getting to the arrangements, what's the recording process like for you guys? I mean, are you the kind of band that, you know, it's go away for as long as you can to put the stuff together? Or is everybody working their jobs and they go to the studio at night? Like, how does it work for Whitney?
I guess when we were demoing, we were working just like kind of odd jobs around Chicago. But when it came time to like fully dive in and like record the actual like final versions of this record, we traveled to LA. And we did the record with Jonathan Rado of Foxygen. I don't know if you guys ever listen to them.
Yeah, sure.
He's like an incredibly talented dude. So yeah, and it really helped. I mean, like, I would have loved to have done it in Chicago, but we had become so obsessed with all the demos in Chicago that I think we needed a change of scenery to just kind of like switch from writing mode to like just full on tracking, right, like recording mode. So
there's a lot of time. A lot of bands do that. I mean, there's this sort of move to try and get away from your familiar surroundings to be able to focus entirely on the music when it's crunch time.
Exactly. Yeah.
So let's talk about obviously the reception for Light Upon the Lake has been great. I mean, you guys have got great thing. You got Pitchfork. People love the music. I think the music's great. The texters texting in love the arrangements of it. What's next for you guys? I mean, obviously you're playing a lot of shows. You got big shows here with Pitchfork. But what's where do you see you guys going for the rest of the year and beyond?
After Pitchfork, I think we're on tour until September.
We're on tour for about a million years. Yeah. But we just
do you like it?
Yeah. Oh, we love it, and it's like, it's what we had kind of been craving while we were writing the music a little bit too. So it's like nice to be fulfilling it, like that craving. But like, I don't know. Yeah, we had our first like real week off in Chicago this week, and we actually like got a lot of work done on like the next the first demo for the next record. So it's like kind of.
You didn't take that time to like chill. Went right back in.
We took like 2 days, just really like getting over jet lag because we were flying in from Europe. But yeah, I just want to, you know, it's like anytime we get a few days home, it's just writing.
No, obviously, because there's a lot meant, a lot sort of talked about when it comes to touring. I mean, the mental and physical fatigue of it. But there's also it's rock and roll. I mean, there's actually a fun part of doing this for a living. But talk about, I mean, for you as a band that's on the way up, people like the music. I mean, I'm always fascinated about when you put a tour together, let's say in Europe or even East Coast, whatever it is. I mean, how are you getting people from show to show? I mean, to come to the show, to pack it up, to nice size venues. I mean, what's the secret? I mean, in this day and age, is it all social media? Is it all just pushing it? Is it who you're touring with? Like, what's the secret to get people to a Whitney show?
I think a lot of it does. Social media and opening for bigger acts are important, but I mean, kind of like in a small, like as a small sample size, like just the way our band grew in Chicago is like playing smaller venues to a couple people and putting on a show good enough for those people when told their friends, and the next show we had, you know, double that until we were, you know, selling out the Empty Bottle, which I still can't believe we did that early in our playing career.
Honestly, I don't. This is like probably a dorky thing to say since we're on radio right now, but like, I just know how much our songs are being played on the radio over in Europe, and it totally blows our minds. Like, we're playing mostly sold out shows over there, and
wow.
I think honestly most of it has to do with radio play.
Does it blow your mind to roll into German club or whatever it is, and you're like, everybody's here and they're singing along
to
the
song?
People
singing, it's people singing the lyrics, and that's kind of how I know that it has to be radio play.
Right.
Because, like, I don't know.
But are you aware? Are you aware of your popularity when you go out that way? I mean, are you kind of skeptical of it? Then you show up and everybody's there singing along, and you're like, "Wow!"
I think this last trip was kind of mind blowing for us. We had a couple of festivals where we played to the largest group of people that this band's ever played in front of.
Yeah,
and it was crazy.
It was like kids in a candy store. It was really intense. Very fun.
Well, that's great. And then you get to come back and play Pitchfork. Yeah, I mean, exactly. Hey, yeah, tougher days. From the band Whitney, the new album Light Upon the Lake. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get one more song from you guys.
Yep.
Here in Studio 435. Stay with us. It's Studio 435 on the download. Justin Kaufman in studio with us is Chicago band Whitney. The new album, Light Upon the Lake, the 7-piece band playing Pitchfork Friday night at 4:15. They're here in studio tonight. Whitney is Max Kakasic, Julian Ehrlich, Josiah Marshall, Will Miller, Malcolm Brown, Print Choteau, and Charles Glanders. And they're going to play one more song for us here. Remember, they're going to be at Pitchfork on Friday night. Here's the song, No Woman. Take it away, guys.
I left drinking on the city train to spend some time on the road. Then one morning I woke up in LA, caught my breath on the coast. I've been going through a change. I might never be sure. I'm just walking in a haze, and I'm not ready to turn. No woman. spend some time on the road.
Yeah, there we go. The band Whitney live in studio 435 tonight. They will be at Pitchfork Music Festival Friday night at 4:15. Their new album, Light Upon the Lake, is just out. Whitney is Max Kasich, Julian Ehrlich, Josiah Marshall, Will Miller, Malcolm Brown, Prince Choteau, and Charles Glanders. Thanks, guys, for coming in tonight and being our guests here at Studio 435. That's going to do it for the download tonight here on WGN Radio. It is Pitchfork Week here on the download, so we will be interviewing Diggable Planets. How great is that, huh? Diggable Planets playing at Pitchfork this weekend. It's not every day you get to say that.
Mm-mm.
I feel like that's something that I've never said or ever thought I would say, but I'm very excited. I've always loved Diggable Planets.
Yeah.
Cool like that. Also, the singer-songwriter and performer Shamir.
Mm-hmm.
Really great stuff.
Yeah.
Shamir is awesome. So Shamir will be on the program as well, and some more stuff this week. We got a lot going on. We essentially, when Pitchfork comes through town, gives us an excuse to talk to a lot of musicians, which I like. I think it's amazing. You know, that festival has brought some of the best indie rock, indie hip-hop. A lot of great musicians from all over the world come in for that festival. So I'm glad that they're responding, and we put requests in, and people want to talk to us. That's good.
Except Carly Rae Jepsen.
What?
She
said no?
Yeah. Well.
Maybe? No, maybe. No, you set me up on that, right? call, maybe? Maybe call? That's okay, right? I'm holding out hope. The one that I'm holding out, this is who I want to see. If I'm going to go to Pitchfork, which I have my dad's big party this weekend, is his anniversary or his birthday party. He's going to be turning the big 7-0.
Oh.
But we're having a big party on Saturday, so I'm going to miss most of the Pitchfork weekend. But who I want to see is Jeremiah. I think that would be pretty great. I love his music. I think he's a great Chicago artist. We've been trying. Doesn't seem to care too much about the WGN.
Not yet.
Not yet. But it's early in the week. We've been trying, but I think he'd be a great... I mean, it's quietly, that artist is involved in some of the most popular music of our time. Quietly. You know, usually if you have the number one hits and things like that, you let everybody know. You know, he's like the antithesis of R. Kelly. R. Kelly, you know, R. Kelly's number one, and he lets you know on records to come for the next 10 records. Like, I'm number one. I was number one. You should check it out. I'm number one. Jeremiah's not like that. You know, like, he's still producing music, and he's got some tremendous, tremendous hits that are played on the radio all the time right now. And it'd be great to talk to him since he's from Chicago, but so far no go. But, Pete, you're optimistic.
Yeah. It's still early in the week. A lot of time left.
A lot of time. You sound like an announcer for the Bears. It's early in the game. A lot of time left.
It's 45-0.
Yeah, right. So, you know what? First quarter. Just battle back. Let's get a couple, string together a couple first downs, see where we're at.
One artist at a time.
One artist at a time. But it's Pitchfork week. It's exciting. And then I believe not too far. I mean, there's a lot going on coming up here. We got Pitchfork, Lollapalooza in town. Not to mention for the show, we have both the RNC and the DNC, which are coming up. Rokan and Anna Vellante is going to go out to cover both conventions. That's awesome.
Next week?
That's awesome. Next week in Cleveland, the week after in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, for the next – and then Bears Camp starts. Bears Camp actually starts, I believe, the 27th of July. So that's 2 weeks from now. That's pretty crazy to think about.
Can't
two
wait.
Weeks and football is on, and it's not going to stop until like February.
I know. I know. Told my
I
wife
don't know if
that.
That's good or bad, right? I just had like a flash to like when the Bears are out of it and it's December, January, and you're just like, But you know, it's funny because Julie said to me earlier this week, she was like, I thought you boycotted Bears stuff. You know, because like last year I was a big thing going, no, I didn't buy no Bears merch. Don't buy me Bears merch.
Mm-hmm.
It was before like this was the end of the Tressman era. I like what they've done.
I like what they're going to be a playoff team.
Like, I like the defensive additions. We'll talk to Adam Hogall about that coming up soon. But there's something about this team that's got a little swagger to it, and it gravitated me closer to, like, you know, a resale Matt Forte jersey. Like, I was close. I was like, oh, maybe I will. But I could see myself with, like, a what's the guy's name? The middle linebacker, Danny Trevathan.
Mm-hmm.
A Trevathan jersey. I could be the Trevathan jersey guy.
They're out there. Let's get them.
All right, Patty Vasquez coming up next here. The Late Night with Patty Vasquez. We will return tomorrow. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago.